Yeah.
Getting out of somewhere in town, right?
Hey, Jeff, cut it off. What's in there?
Good evening.
Yeah.
I would like to call this Monday, March 26, 2012, Planning Commission meeting to order. Kim, if you would take the roll call, please.
Chairman Lutz.
Here.
Commissioner Demarest.
Here.
Commissioner Christensen.
Present.
Commissioner Rodman.
Here.
Commissioner Sherwood.
Here.
Commissioner Tuttle.
Here.
Thank you.
This is the time of the meeting where we take comments from citizens on anything that is not on the agenda tonight. Is there anyone wishing to make comments to the Planning Commission on any item not on the agenda? Seeing no hands, we will move on. We have no minutes this evening or public hearings. So our first workshop is ZCA 2012-01, Cannabis Collective Gardens. And this evening we will have Mr. Scott Snyder present to us. Paul, is there anything you need to say beforehand? Great. Thank you, Mr. Snyder. We'll turn it over to you.
Good evening. Again, Scott Snyder. I'm a member at Ogden Murphy Walls, Zach Lowe, who's worked with you and speaks highly of him, his partner. And I've been our designated point person on medical marijuana for the last couple of years. I've been working with Candace Bach, who's the AWC lobbyist. We've been making numerous presentations. Probably the short version of this is this is another fine mess that the federal government and the state have gotten you into. The U.S. drug policy, since it began in 1906, has been a mess. It hasn't been scientific. The federal government is part of the Temperance Union. If you've seen Prohibition, the Ken Burns series, you've got an idea of the roots of federal response. And it's fascinating, really, in the sense that initially the federal government took a taxation approach that made nothing illegal. California was the first state to make first opium and then marijuana illegal at a state level because they were concerned about Chinese and Mexican immigrants. We've come full cycle now with California being one of the 17 states that have legalized or decriminalized medical marijuana. There are 17 states with laws like this and seven who are currently are under consideration by the state legislature. I think one of the two important things to bear in mind is that as far as the federal government is concerned, marijuana is an illegal Schedule I drug with no medical purpose whatsoever. The Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, which is the D.C. Circuit, and the DEA have six times refused to reclassify marijuana over the last 40 years. You may have read Governor Greg Ward had a summit of governors in the 24 states who are looking at it. I sat in on part of that conversation. Basically, it's one of those political footballs. Nothing's going to happen at the federal level. The federal government has consistently pressed its right to regulate drugs, liberal or conservative, every attorney general and every president in the last 40 years has stressed the federal government's power to take action. John Ashcroft, under Bush, the attorney general, took two California grandmothers to the U.S. Supreme Court in Reich versus Gonzalez to make the point that the federal government had the right to regulate four pot plants grown by these senior citizens in their backyard. You may have heard of the Ogden memo, which was a definitive memo put forward by the assistant criminal attorney general for the United States about 10 years ago, which basically set forth that as far as federal government is concerned, marijuana is an illegal drug, and any state or local involvement that enables the industry is subject to prosecution. This is what Governor Gregoire relied on when she vetoed portions of legislation that was passed in last year's legislative session. So, lesson number one, as far as the federal government is concerned, marijuana has no appropriate use whatsoever. As I said, on the other hand, 17 states and potentially 24 have taken a different stance. In the Medical Use of Marijuana Act, MUMA, when it was first enacted by the state legislature, was based on the premise that the state, bear with me here for a little legalism, but the federal government, when it enacts legislation, it can preempt local action in four different ways. Expressly by saying so, by completely covering a field. The one that concerns us here is if the federal government makes something illegal, a state can't make it legal. But what the 21 states have done have said that Ken Burns in the Prohibition documentary, what 21 states have said is we're not going to use state resources to pursue medical marijuana, that you have a defense against state prosecution. When that act was enacted by initiative, it led to a proliferation of distributorships, the Green Health, Herb Solutions. All you need to do is Google medical marijuana in Monroe, and you'll find that there are a lot of dispensaries you didn't know existed, in your community or near to it. I'm always amazed that the information is readily available. We mentioned the Ogden memo. The Spokane and Seattle City Attorney, U.S. attorneys, have similarly warned the state and cities that they'll take action. Spokane actually has. They've basically cleaned out anything that looks like a dispensary. Seattle, being Seattle, they've written threatening letters but to Clark County and a number of other entities, but they haven't actually done anything yet. Back to MUMA, the Medical Use of Marijuana Act. It had a bunch of gaping holes. Dispensaries. Where do dispensaries get medical marijuana? And the answer would be from illegal grow operations scattered throughout the state. In the 2011 legislative session, the state legislature enacted a comprehensive scheme that involved the State Department of Agriculture in the testing and processing of marijuana and establishing THC levels. It provided for dispensaries and collective gardens and a variety of other things that got the state knee-deep in the regulation of the industry, participating in the industry. This brought the federal government down on the state, and they contacted Governor Gregoire. Governor Gregoire wrote a letter, politically staged. And 2 days later, if you know how the federal government works, you don't get a letter back from the U.S. attorney in 2 days. But it basically is a repeat of what I referred to earlier as the Ogden memo. Don't get involved in it. Everything you need to do has to be hands-off. That creates one clear thing that states can do, which, again, as I said, is simply say we're not going to use state resources to prosecute people with a doctor's. It's not a prescription. It's a written recommendation that they consider medical marijuana. So doctors and patients have a defense if they're criminally prosecuted. The problem has always been, how do these people, if they don't have a green thumb, obtain the drug that their doctor may recommend? As I said, under MUMA, there were all these dispensaries grew up. I think we should be clear that this is a multi-million dollar industry. The State Department of Commerce estimated that if ESSB 5073 had gone into effect, that cannabis sales in Washington would have approached $1 billion by 2015. The San Francisco Business Journal estimated that 1% of American electrical generation is devoted to marijuana grow operations. We're talking big business. And what that means for you, you're talking about a well-financed industry who's proved willing to litigate again and again, despite losing in federal court. They've in Michigan, California, we'll talk about some of the cases in a minute. Right now, let's talk about biting the hand that feeds you. There's a case called John and Jane Doe 1 through 15 versus the City of Seattle, where a group of industry people are suing the City of Seattle, which has got to be the most liberal jurisdiction, because they're required to get a business license and thereby somehow violate their Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination by saying that they're dispensing medical marijuana. So again, the question is going to be, how do you comply with federal law and state law at the same time? So we're back to MUMA. The legislature in 2011 enacts this scheme. The governor vetoed basically everything, and if you're interested, I can run through what was vetoed. But she vetoed on the theory that she did not want state workers exposed to criminal prosecution. In reality, no local or state official has been prosecuted by the federal government since Reconstruction in the 1870s, you know, after the Civil War. But the threat's always been there. And cases like Reich versus Gonzalez that I mentioned, the federal government has shown that, you know, they're willing to put a lot of resources into it from time to time in isolated instances to pound people. In Washington, the dilemma is different. After the governor had vetoed the bill, what was left? And the answer was collective gardens. Now, as originally proposed, and this is one of those, I don't know, it's no good deed goes unpunished, or, you know, the law of unintended consequences. The governor's idea was, well, you can go, groups of patients can come together and conduct a collective garden. They closed one loophole and opened another. One of the provisions that the governor didn't veto was one that made it clear that basically dispensaries were illegal. And that said that a provider, because dispensaries, their theory was, we're designated providers to people with medical marijuana recommendations. And what the legislature enacted and the governor left in the bill was a provision that said, you have to wait 15 days after you've served one patient before you serve the other. And the way most dispensaries work, you walk in, you sign up, you become their patient for as long as it takes you to buy whatever amount of grams of medical marijuana you want. They cease to be the patient, you walk out the door, and they're ready for the next patient. By saying they had to wait 15 days, meaning you could have two customers a month, they basically ended dispensaries as dispensaries. Well, what's happened, collective gardens were envisioned by the state law enforcement community as a reasonable alternative in the context of the bill, because, you know, they're thinking collective garden, probably like you, a collective garden is a garden. You know, it's somewhere, it's going to be in a building, probably for security purposes, it's going to be a grow operation. There's a company in Mount Vernon that has a cubicle that sort of looks like a tanning booth that, you know, you basically plant your seed and close the door and come back, you know, a month later, and there's your harvestable product. Again, a lot of money here. But when the governor left gardens in place, she also left in place a provision that is really the heart of what we're talking about, let me turn to it, that enables, let's call it section 1102 of the bill, and it says, cities and towns may adopt and enforce any of the following pertaining to the production, processing, or dispensing of cannabis or cannabis products within their jurisdiction. Zoning requirements, business licensing requirements, health and safety requirements, and business taxes. Nothing limits the authority to the city to impose zoning requirements or other conditions, so long as the requirements do not, here's the key word, preclude the possibility of citing licensed dispensers within the jurisdiction. Okay? The dispenser provisions were vetoed by the governor with the exception of that one provision that put them clearly out of business. So no one's quite sure what that means. If the jurisdiction has no commercial zones, the jurisdiction is not required to adopt zoning to accommodate licensed dispensers. Think Medina or Woodway or some other small town that doesn't have a business strip. So where does that take us? We're now in a situation where you're required by state law somewhere within your boundaries to provide for collective gardens. If you become over-involved, and if you don't do that, you're subject to a lawsuit from the industry. If you get overly involved, you're also subject to an industry lawsuit, a federal lawsuit. The state of California right now has a lawsuit pending before its state Supreme Court that with the city of Long Beach went way, way overboard. They decided to have a lottery. And for $10,000, you could apply to be in the lottery. And they had 46 come in. They decided they were going to have a lottery for 32 collective garden spots in their community. At that point, a lawsuit was brought on the premise that, you know, you can't get that involved in the industry. That's precluded by federal law because you're, in effect, enabling a federal crime. California Court of Appeals agreed that's on appeal. So what do you have? You're caught between the feds at one hand and their threats and the reality that you need to make some provision eventually. And I say that because most cities have interim zoning regulations or moratorium in effect. And you have to make a provision for collective gardens. Now, the irony is that in almost every city that sees collective gardens, they are not collective gardens. I am totally unaware of any city that has a true collective garden in effect. What you have are rebranded dispensaries. All the dispensaries are now collective gardens. And where are they getting their marijuana? From the same illegal grow operations that are out there and have been for years. Well, the ones that don't get caught. So, to kind of wrap this up for you, your task here is to find a place in your community for collective gardens. And to do so in a way that has the least city involvement. So our recommendations, to kind of put them forward, one, remember that marijuana collective gardens, and again, I hope I'm not coming down for or against medical marijuana as an issue. I'm just talking about the legal realities here. You have to provide for it somewhere in your community, but unlike, say, adult entertainment, there's no First Amendment right involved. You have to have a place, but it can be three city lots you have to provide a place. There's no federal constitutional right to have this like there is with adult entertainment to have some sort of viable district. You've got to provide for it. Our recommendation is that you do so, find a spot in your community that has the least impact, zone it that way. Do not get the planning department involved in counting plants, checking stuff out, things like special use permits, conditional use permits, where you're holding hearings and getting involved and trying to judge, you know, what people think, whether it's an appropriate use and where. And you can have distancing requirements if you don't want them clustered together, or you can take sometimes it's called erogenous zoning and an adult entertainment setting and put them all in one spot where police can keep an eye on it. The other issue that tends to come up in context here are business license permits. And a lot of cities, and you've got a dilemma here. Should you exempt what's theoretically a federal illegal business from normal building code and fire inspection? You know, should you give them some sort of break so that you're not involved? What a number of cities have done is to say, because it's illegal under federal law, we're not going to issue a business license. We are going to issue a compliance certificate. So you get all of your inspections and you come in. So we're sure if you do have a grow operation that your proper, your electrical system is properly set up to handle it, and you're not going to cause a fire and cause problems for your neighbors. Last thing just to bear in mind is dispensaries are clearly illegal. If you start having problems with something that's clearly a dispensary, you've got your police department with all the tools necessary under state and federal law to shut down a problem location. So keep it simple. Have the least involvement. Make some place in your community for it. And consider whether you want to structure your business license provisions just to protect surrounding property owners and make sure that the basic safety, health safety requirements are taken care of. Happy to answer questions. I got a lot more information if you're curious.
Great.
That's the short term.
Thank you. I have one quick question, and that is, I haven't followed this this issue very much, but it sounds like we have an initiative that was passed, and we also have a bill that was passed that was vetoed down to a very small bill. The court system, as I understand it, reviews all these things to see if they're constitutional and if they can stand. And has it gone through that process?
It has not. And again, this is going to be a constantly moving target. You've got an initiative now that former U.S. attorney and Rick Steves, God love him, have brought forward that would basically legalize marijuana, decriminalize it entirely within the state, do away with, I don't want to call it a sham, but the number of 18-year-olds that have medical conditions that require medical marijuana is amazing, you know. If that initiative passes, then you know the state's going to be hip deep in the federal government. That'll be working its way to the U.S. Supreme Court pretty quick. Well, pretty quick in U.S. Supreme Court terms is about 5 years. I've been there. Second thing is, while nothing is going to happen in a state election year, you can count on that. Assume that the state legislature is going to be back taking a look at this. In 2013, Senator Wells Cole, who had sponsored the last bit of round of legislation, just got tired. You know, this was enormously wearing. Obviously, with state budgetary problems, this was not something that was on the state legislature's agenda. Short, long answer to your simple question, and that's that it's constantly changing, and it's going to continue to change over the next 3 or 4 years.
Great. Thank you. Commissioners, any questions for Mr. Schneider?
Yeah.
Jeff? I saw your hand first. Sorry.
What if we just say we're not going to do anything about this? Are we absolutely mandated, required? Is there going to be some sort of fine levy against the city?
Okay, if you do nothing, what I suggest you have is, my guess is you don't regulate people's vegetable gardens. It's probably a vegetable gardens or a use. And what you could end up with is the gardens in residential neighborhoods. They appoint you to decide whether that's a good idea. I think in most communities, they'd like, if they're going to be operations, they'd like them segregated from residential communities. And another thing, by the way, that comes up on that is, if you're going to get into it, to clarify that a collective garden / dispensary is not an appropriate home use occupation.
Thank you. Wayne?
Well, yes, I was going to ask if how long it could take, but you just answered my question. Now, we have...
If you're thinking about how long could you sustain a moratorium, let me give you... I'll give you sort of the jaded city attorney viewpoint and then an appropriate legislative finding would be. The jaded city attorney point of view is that many communities are hesitant to lift their moratorium because they don't want to be a dumping ground. They don't want to be the first one that opens up. It's particularly true in South Snohomish County and North Pierce County. You've got a lot of little communities. Fife and Milton and Edgewood side by side. So they're trying to proceed in lockstep. Now, there are three appropriate reasons, I think, to take your time. One is PAC versus City of Long Beach. That's the California Supreme Court case that's raising the issue of what level of local regulation is prohibited, in other words, in conflict with local law. The second is, what's going to happen with the marijuana initiative? Are the rules going to change on you again at the next major election? That's going to be interesting to have a presidential election and something like that on the ballot at the same time. Those are two reasons. And a third would be if, you know, you need to take your time, you need to make progress, but if you have other things on your agenda that take your time, you know, that can be a part of appropriate legislative findings. So there are two good legal reasons and then one related to your own agenda to take your time.
And also, the state is pretty well requiring us to do this, I take it.
You've got to make some provision somewhere in your community for gardens. Yes,
the state also owns the property in the city of Monroe. And if we make, if we were to put this as the Washington State Reformatory, be the put this, that would kind of put it right back. Those guys up there probably know how to grow it, too.
So. I like the expertise. I think your problem is going to be, it needs to be typically in some sort of commercial zone or a commercial, industrial, or agricultural zone, because basically a private property owner is going to have access to it. So putting it on, I like your style, but I don't think we're going to get away with that.
Dave?
Scott, your comment about perhaps not wanting to be first out the door. Are there other communities out there that have been out the door or are out the door with adopted ordinances that we might benefit from looking at?
Well, I'll tell you, I spoke at the AWC convention in Spokane, the Candace Bach convention. What I was totally unprepared for, speaking in Spokane particularly to local legislators, was that 80% of the people in the room, and there were maybe 300 people, flat didn't care and thought, you know, that the federal government ought to mind its own business. And the other 20% were sort of Tea Party people who thought that the federal government absolutely positively shouldn't have anything to do with the state. So I was really unprepared. And the short answer is there are a number of communities which have simply designated part of their commercial district. Mukilteo is one. That have provided for distancing requirements. And, you know, they're just letting it rip. And what they've got is clearly rebranded dispensary, and their theory is that, you know, if they need to do something, then let the police take care of it. If, you know, they begin to overstep their bounds, almost all the negative consequences of dispensaries or collective gardens, because again, you're not going to see, it'll be the rare community that sees a true collective garden. They're out there somewhere in the woods. There, theoretically, you know, you could have a greenhouse operation. There's a company in Everett that are turning storage lockers into individual collective gardens, which is one of the reasons why people wanted distancing requirements. So you don't end up with 20 collective gardens in one building. I'm sorry, I strayed from your question.
Other ordinances that are
already... Yeah, basically... Went astray, is almost every negative impact that you can think of, people smoking marijuana in the parking lot, people reselling in the neighborhood, all those sorts of things are currently illegal under state and federal law. So your police can have more than a handle on the secondary impacts. So, yes, there are a number of communities, of Seattle most prominently, even though they're getting sued. I live in Leschi, and believe me, Capitol Hill's another world. You know? Just read The Stranger, that you'll find five or six collective garden ads in every issue.
Thank you.
I have another question, so I just want to make sure I'm clear on this. You're saying we need to do something, but we can take our time. Mm-hmm. But if we do take our time, does that mean we can start seeing some of these things crop up in the neighborhoods? And because I understood that if we do something, we can prevent that. So I guess I'm...
Well, I mean, you can have a moratoria on the establishment of collective gardens pending, like any other zoning moratoria. So you'd make the use illegal until such time as you had enacted ordinances. And, you know, that's where taking your appropriate collective time, evaluating what's going on in other states and seeing what happens with the medical marijuana initiative is a reasonable basis. I'm sure you've had moratoria in the past, and as you know, you need to make clear legislative findings. You have to have either initially or afterwards at the council level a public hearing. You can enact interim zoning regulations, or you can enact moratoria as an expedited process.
Great, that makes sense. So we can make a moratorium, get that going, and then allow us to have time to do some further research before we create an ordinance.
Paul, is there a moratorium in effect now?
There is. I think it's in effect till June 6th. I understand if we decide to extend the moratorium, we have to have a public hearing before it expires.
Yes, sir.
But there is one potential solution if we decide to establish an ordinance, and that we do have a, what you call an erogenous zone within our business park. It's a block. The collective gardens could potentially be limited or restricted to that area. It's within a industrial zone. So explicitly defined, that could be an answer.
And what are the advantages from the local point of view? Again, the less involvement that your planning department has, the better. The police are better suited for it. So, having a clearly defined zone, and particularly if it's limited in size and, you know, competition, that has distinct advantages. Many police officials believe that simply restricting and knowing where the problem is the first step toward controlling it.
Dave?
Paul mentioned the zone that we have in the industrial park. You mentioned that a city should not go too far in specific regulatory aspects of the ordinance.
Just the involvement aspect. I think that the type of thing, again, Long Beach is totally over the top in terms of locating and choosing and selecting, which led to that lawsuit. I think an example would be special use permits, where you individually locate and have hearings and consider each and every location of a collective garden. You know, you're going to create a record that easily can get you sued, either by the industry or the federal government. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm saying is our recommendation. If you're going to do an outright permitted use in a very narrowly defined zone, leaves the least city fingerprints on it. You've provided for it as the state requires, but only to the extent that the state requires. And again, it needn't be as broad as your entire erogenous zone.
You mentioned earlier an aspect that might be restrict location proximity. Mm-hmm. One to another. The area that Paul's referring to has many big empty buildings currently. Would it be unreasonable to include in such an ordinance a limitation on the size of any one operation?
Well, again, that's going to be self-limiting because a collective garden is limited. Let me pull that up. I think it's 45 plants, you know, and 15. And so the provisions that are still in effect that define that, because I think that's a good question. That's one of the problems with PowerPoint presentations when you're flipping through. Okay, a collective garden can serve 10 qualifying patients. It's 15 plants per patient with a 45 plant maximum. Now, and that's plants at all levels of maturation. 24 ounces per patient with a 72-ounce maximum product available to the dispensary. And you're not to deliver except to qualifying patients. Are you curious how dispensaries are getting around this? It's a great scam. The dispensary owner is a patient, and whoever's growing it is a patient. And they've got 8 empty slots. And remember I said that the state legislature cured the dispensary problem? But they left the same loophole open in collective gardens. So you sign up new patients. And when your garden runs out of product, you then bring in another patient who's another one of the illegal grow operations. So you manipulate your 10 slots to have the buyer, the seller, and the grower involved.
Jim? Could it be as simple as adding a collective garden as a permitted use in a narrowly defined zone such as the zone of the industrial area?
I think that would be the guts of it. Two other things I'd suggest you consider. The home use occupation, that it's not an appropriate home use occupation, and layering your business license provision. I realize that wouldn't necessarily come from your recommendation, but it's one that could, as a company, as a staff recommendation, just to provide a compliance certificate. You know, your legislative findings are going to say, according to federal law, this is illegal. According to state law, we've got to provide for it. We're stuck in the middle. We're going to do what we're required to do, but only what we're required to do.
Thank you. Bill?
You mentioned about patients are those the people that would actually go in and use that property to grow the plants, or do they have to apply to the city before they can go in there and grow the plants?
No, sir, that's regulated by the state. It's something you don't have to be involved in. As I said, it as envisioned, you know, you're talking about small-scale grow operations, 10 people, 15 plants. In practice, again, what we've got are rebranded distributorships, which are, you know, just going to be a storefront sales operation. So, you know, one of the things, somebody mentioned the large empty warehouses, you're putting it in a zone that's well-suited for the intended use as it went through the legislature, which would be some sort of indoor grow operation where you could have security and ventilation and all the things that are necessary to have a good crop. So putting it in that zone makes perfect sense in terms of what the legislature intended. Might not be the best sales location, but you know, having it separated probably from your downtown business district, I'm sure the merchants downtown will thank you. There's a small town in Colorado that has two stores, one gas station, 5 bars and 7 distributorships. It's between Aspen and Vail, you know.
Dave?
Oh, sure. Bill, will you?
I wondered if so what keeps in this collective garden, what keeps, you know, say you have 30 patients and you have a restriction on how many patients will be growing at any one time, who manages that? How does that get managed?
The short answer would be the police department. And if you actually want to put resources together, I'd suggest it's not, your planners aren't going to be getting search warrants and going in and conducting late night surveillance. So unless you guys want to volunteer, it's not normally the role of the planning department. That would be a police tool. Because again, the exemption for collective garden, you're going to just adopt the state definition.
Gotcha.
And again, the scam is it's going to be a constantly rotating 10. Patients. But if somebody actually has a grow operation, there'll be 10 registered individuals. And I think although it's going to be rare, there will be legitimate grow operations. They're just going to be few and far between in terms of, you know, what you're actually going to see in your community.
Well, thank you.
Yes, sir.
Dave?
Is there a concern with, when you look at the ordinance from the perspective of you identify an area, a zone where it can go, you maybe include some criteria with regard to proximity from one to another. Is there a concern with the ordinance resulting in two, almost an exclusionary area where, gee, we can fit one or two in, but not three?
And again, that's what I refer to as the difference between this and adult entertainment. Adult entertainment, you have to have a viable commercial district. You have to have sufficient property for people to actually locate. Here you just got to provide for it. One's enough. You know, so if you particularly, I'm intrigued by your warehouse district. If you want to have a boundary and take a look at the district, and you'd want to define this up front, you wouldn't want to look at it on a case by case basis. But take your erogenous zone, look and make sure your 500. Again, there are two ways to look. Do you want them all in one place where the police can keep their eye on them, or do you want them dispersed so that they're not an attractive nuisance? Given if you've got a good industrial zone with a lot of empty warehouse-type space, clustering may make the most sense for you. Again, that's one of the questions. Do you, and define the boundaries as 500 feet from bus stops, schools, daycare centers, you know, churches, bars, you can think of it. And, you know, you start drawing circles. You'd want to do that up front so you're not measuring it initially. But, again, I this is one where I suggest less is more.
Interesting. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
I have a question, I guess, for staff. It sounds like you're wanting to move forward with this to an actual ordinance instead of extending the moratorium. Is that how I understand this, or...?
Well, I'm a little unclear whether we should actually begin discussing an ordinance. This is scheduled to go to council, I think, in early May for a go, no-go decision or direction for putting an ordinance together. My moratorium is expiring June 6th, so that's a critical date. And I'm not sure that it would be a good use of the commission's time to try and deal with this if, in fact, council decides to extend the moratorium. Because I don't think it's going to be terribly difficult to put together. As Scott says, the best idea is to keep it simple. But we should know more maybe before our next meeting.
So it sounds like we either need to come up with an ordinance quickly, or we need to decide that we're going to suggest the council extend the moratorium and look at this maybe next year. Is that
6 months?
6 months.
Yeah, you have to review it every 6 months. And you know what you might want to do, just and depending on what your council's looking for, is to say, you know, and we'd be glad to, by the way, back up our advice with two-page council-worthy memo, you know, on hitting the high points. We spent a lot of time talking about some interesting history, but talk about keeping it simple and what you've got to do and what that narrow boundary is that you can control, and say, do you want us to look at that, or given PAC versus Long Beach and the state initiative and other uses of our time, would you like us to defer action until we know a little better what the landscape looks like?
Thank you. So I guess my next question is, has council weighed in on this situation?
Not yet. I don't recall the date, but it's coming fairly soon, and the objective is to get a decision from council as to whether they'd like to build an ordinance or extend the moratorium. If I had to guess, I'm thinking that the logical choice might be based on there are so many unknowns at this point, particularly the fall initiative, that it may be smartest to extend the moratorium rather than spend quite a bit of time putting in an ordinance that may have to be changed in 6 months. That's just one opinion.
Sure, and I think with the schedule that we have and the fact that City Council, you know, delegates what we're going to do, I think it'd be good to get their viewpoint. I appreciate getting a much more clear understanding of what this is, what this is about. Commissioners, any other questions? Comments on this item? I guess we're done. So, yeah, we could maybe figure out what council's preference is. Sounds like it probably would need to to at least extend it for 6 more months until we have more time to review it and see what else is happening out there.
I'll try and bring some better information to the next meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Schneider. That was very informative.
Thank you.
All right. The next item on our agenda is CPA 2012-01, First Airfield Comprehensive Plan Amendment and Rezone. And before we delve into that, I believe, Dave, you wanted to make a comment or two?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to read a statement into the record. Thursday, March 22nd, I was contacted by Peter Hickey, owner-broker of Windermere Real Estate in Kirkland. Peter shared that he had had discussions with two of his agents, Kevin Donovan and Dave Hopkins, regarding my participating as a planning commissioner in the First Airfield Comprehensive Plan Amendment process. Kevin is a listing agent and Dave apparently has a buyer. Peter had been asked to convey to me that my participation could create a potential conflict of interest due to my association with Windermere Real Estate. He told me they had been advised my participation could prove detrimental to the process regardless of what direction my vote might be cast. Peter told me he would be sending me a letter requesting that I recuse myself. I told Peter that a process exists for commissioners to recuse themselves and that a process also exists for concerned parties to request a commissioner step down. I suggested that if his agents or others had concerns, utilizing such an approach would probably be better than a letter from him to me. On Friday, I received a call from Kevin Donovan. Kevin told me that he had met with Peter and Dave and that they had decided that at this time they would not be pursuing any challenge to my participation in the First Airfield process. There are two reasons for my raising this issue tonight. First, I believe it is important that all parties be aware of these discussions. Second, I want to clarify for the record the relationship, or more accurately, the lack of any significant relationship that exists with regard to Kevin, Peter, Dave, and myself. As an agent with Windermere Real Estate, I've known Peter and Kevin for years. Prior to my stepping down as manager of the Monroe office of Windermere Real Estate in the fall of 2008, Peter and I interacted frequently on a management level. And as a matter of fact, Kevin began his real estate career with us here in Monroe. He left before I took over as manager in 2000. I've known Dave Slattery as another Windermere agent. Peter's Windermere office in Kirkland and Windermere Real Estate office in Monroe are both franchise firms, and each is 100% independently owned of each other. I have no ownership interest in the Monroe office, any other franchise office, or the parent company, Windermere Real Estate Services. And lastly, I have no recent, current, or anticipated business involvement with any of the parties involved in this process. As a result, I see no potential conflict of interest that could arise from my association with Windermere Real Estate and Monroe and my participating in the First Airfield Comprehensive Plan Amendment and Rezone. Thank you.
Thank you. And I believe, Mr. Schneider, you had offered to make some comments about, we have a city ordinance. Our ethics code.
Yes, sir. I'm passing along information that's passed from Zach Well, your city attorney. So I'm sort of passing along his advice. You have a very unique ethics provision in that it covers potential conflicts, and while it applies to boards and commission members, the key section says public officials and city employees shall not take part in any council action, as that term is defined by state statute, concerning a contract, property, or other matter of any kind in which the public official or immediate family has a financial interest or otherwise creates a conflict of interest. As set forth by the commissioner, you can see that he doesn't have a current interest. And I think our office is understand two other things, too, that your ethics ordinance has been consistently very broadly applied. This is one where there is not a clear answer in the ordinance itself for this situation. I think our opinion as your city attorney is that the better argument is, one, there's no conflict of interest or potential conflict of interest in the current situation. If you found it, common sense dictates if that were true, no real estate professional could ever serve on your planning commission and make a recommendation. That would be true of an appraiser, so sales, you might get a referral somewhere in the future, who knows. The other thing I think to be pointed out is this deals with council actions. this, you're making a recommendation to a legislative body who will make a mixed quasi-judicial land use decision somewhere down the line, but you're not taking the action. Again, I think our feeling is that the better position is it doesn't apply, but that any council member, commission member needs to bear in mind that somebody can make a complaint, mud can be slung, and your ethics commission can be involved. And the wording of your ordinance is so loose that they might make a contrary decision. Our advice is, the better argument is, both from a common sense and legal point of view, that it doesn't apply. However.
Thank you.
Certainly.
Commissioners, any questions? Mr. Snyder? If I may, there's been discussion about property owners that are nearby, and I don't know if we would want to address that. Bill, I know you're a property owner nearby, but is there... I think we've kind of figured out that...
I'm not even nearby. I'm directly adjacent to the airport property.
Right, and I think, if I remember correctly, we've determined that there's not much of a conflict of interest, but if you felt like there was an issue...
There's no conflict of interest as far as I can see, but I have strong feelings that pertain to this particular amendment. So I probably should not be sitting in judgment on this particular thing.
But as the commission member notes, if you've made up your mind before you've had a public hearing, probably best to recuse yourself.
Yeah. Great, thank you. And then I just wanted to give us an opportunity if you wanted to for that. Thank you very much, Mr. Schneider.
Thank you.
Okay, well, with that, we will proceed. Planning Manager Opelka will be giving us the introduction for this.
Should I sit down on this or...
Sure, Lloyd. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott.
My pleasure.
I brought some information tonight regarding this first air. We've done, well, the three things in the report here. One is the staff analysis of the amendment in terms of its how it meets the requirements of the comprehensive plan amendment process. The other is some more discussion about the LOSA definition and the permitted uses. We did some analysis of the traditional process being judging whether this amendment is following the requirements of our resolution, the city resolution for reviewing comp plan amendments. And I won't go into a lot of detail, but it comes down to whether it has an adverse effect to the public welfare, whether it's consistent with our comp plan and with the GMA and applicable state and federal laws, and whether it's how it's weighed in light of what are the cumulative effects of this amendment in relation to other proposed amendments and the rest of the community. And in, you know, it's in staff's opinion that this does meet these criteria, no adverse effect. Comprehensive plan, in your report, there's a number of goals and policies that directly and indirectly support this amendment, particularly the one land use goal and several policies related to First Air Field itself for economic vitality and the essential use of the airport. Some additional criteria that had to do with whether it meets the needs of the city. As the city grows, whether this amendment is in support of the future needs that result from that growth. And since this is an essential public facility, and in my opinion, it does in fact work toward that end.
it's a means toward that end. There are environmental impacts. In this case, they've been disclosed and will have to be mitigated. And on the note, there is a draft phase environmental impact statement that has to be issued perhaps as early as tomorrow or the next day for First Air that does identify several alternatives, but each alternative is basically has the same effects in terms of how different parcels might be developed in this airport. That is going to be coming out here very, very soon. And of course, with the extension of the runway, we're talking about filling wetland. That is an impact that can be mitigated in a number of ways. Part of the strategy here is for the applicant, the owner, to do a land trade with the city. In that western triangle, basically swapping that out for the area that's below Commissioner Christensen's house there, north of where it says First Air Field, as a part of that mitigation process. And they also talk about doing some wetland restoration and some stream restoration. But that is subject to more detail in a supplemental EIS that would come out when this proposal is actually taking some teeth in some specific proposals. So beyond that, is it dealing with growth projections? Is it compatible? And is it compatible with neighboring land use, and is it compatible with and supportive of other comp plan elements and the intent of that comprehensive plan? And, there could be some debate about whether it's truly compatible with neighboring land uses, but personally, I don't really see a significant impact. We have fairly light traffic in airplanes coming in and out of the airport. I think the larger problem, although it's short-lived, is the fairgrounds and the racetrack, which create quite a bit of noise, the racetrack in particular. But in the context of this project, I don't see a hurdle in this category. We've gone through the CEPA process and vetted it through that, or will have by the time this is complete. And so based on that, in the staff judgment, this does meet the basic tenets of our process. That it is the big one, I think, is that it is consistent with the comprehensive plan. It's supported by the plan. And yes, there are some environmental impacts that will be addressed in more detail. They've been identified, just like East Monroe. They will be addressed in more detail as this goes along. So, can I entertain some questions about that portion of this? This is really groundwork toward a month from now, hopefully making some kind of final decision and recommendation on this project.
If I could, real quick. Are we planning, I can't recall, I don't have the schedule in front of me, are we planning on doing a public hearing on the environmental impact statement as we did with the other property, or are we just going to, traditionally we hadn't done that before, are we just going to let it go through its normal process of letters and then go through just one public hearing basically on the project as a whole?
I forgot to mention the commission has a public hearing on April 23rd for the comp plan amendment, and there is going to be a public hearing, I think it's on April 12th, for the environmental impact statement. It's a Thursday. It's a standalone public hearing, which is typically, okay, I think, how it's been done in the past. But.
So we will be having a public hearing on the environmental impact statement at our next meeting, which I believe is the second Monday of April. And then at the fourth Monday in April, we'll be having a public hearing on the comprehensive plan amendment itself.
No one, yes. The public hearing for the environmental impact statement is not actually an official commission function as a standalone public hearing and more of an administrative managed public hearing.
Oh, okay, so that's not going to be here with the commission.
I guess the way we handled it with Eastman Rockies was an exception to how it's typically been done in the past.
Correct.
But, and I didn't really have any problem with that strategy, being that the commission has so much on her plate for our regular meetings. And this EIS is fairly straightforward. I think the environmental impacts are pretty limited. They're pretty broad in terms of the quantity, the amount of tilling that's potentially possible, but very limited number of potential impacts in it.
Okay, so then we will be not be having the commission will not be having a public hearing on that.
Right.
Correct. Okay, and then we really can't have a public hearing on the comprehensive plan amendment until after the time period has passed. Is that right for this environmental impact statement? Is there a reporting requirement timeline that we have? Because my next thought, to jump ahead, was why not have this earlier if we're almost done with workshops? Because I know that the 23rd is looking like a very busy night. And we'll do it, but I didn't know modifying that schedule.
I think the comment period, the scoping period for the impact statement is done, and I don't recall, I should have checked this, when the comment period ends. I believe it's 15 days after it's issued, so that would be early mid-April for that comment period to end, and then after that the final EIS is revised and issued.
So it sounds like the 23rd
would be in hand.
It's probably the earliest we could really have a public hearing for that anyway.
Well, okay, so yeah.
I didn't mean to sidetrack us there. Dave, you had a question?
Well, would the time frames on that process be the same as the EIS time frames that were rolled out of East Monroe, as far as comment periods and everything else?
Yeah. I think it's 15 days comment period.
I think it was a 30 day on that one.
Is it 30?
Yeah, because it was the end of March, I believe.
It is 30.
Yeah.
Okay.
So is there a problem with us holding the hearing on the comp plan amendment prior to the EIS process being done and a final?
I don't think so, because they're two separate processes. That's a good question, but I don't believe the environmental impact, that the final EIS has to be completed and through its coming period before a commission can make its recommendation. But I will check.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Because I don't know how much more information we would need, because I think we probably would have another workshop if we were going to have our public hearing on the 23rd of April. Would we have another workshop on first air? Or I don't perceive it as being pretty much hashed out, but maybe not.
I think depending on what happens tonight, we may want to bring it back on the 9th. And we may well want to do that just to barring any changes in some of the details of the definition or the uses and so forth. We do not have a zoning application in hand yet, but I've asked for that. In fact, East Monroe is bringing in a zoning application. So tentatively, I plan to bring it back next meeting if there's a need to do so, depending on how we work through this tonight. And it may be good to bring it back just to dot the I's and cross the T's before the 23rd when we have our public hearing.
All right. So you think maybe the 9th is probably too early for a public hearing on this then?
I guess that's another option, is to hold a public, I know that we'd like to have a public hearing the night. I think the night we make a recommendation.
Yeah. Right. And that's what I was thinking, maybe have a public hearing and a recommendation, unless commissioners after this evening
have
more questions, maybe it needs. But I get the feeling, maybe I'm alone in this, that we're pretty close on this.
I think so. Right now, the 23rd, we have First Air coming up, East Monroe, and the North Tulsi downtown. Tonight's just our first time talking about North Tulsi.
And we're planning on doing that on the 23rd also?
At this point.
Okay. So that's why I was thinking, if if some of these that I get my mind, and I'd like to hear from the other commissioners, maybe it's too early right now, we'll have finished our discussion, but maybe have that public hearing and decision on the 9th.
And, you know, we could also, based on that meeting, we could potentially continue the public hearing once to the 23rd, if there was a business that's unfinished. Or close the public hearing and not take action that night and have some further discussion. I believe there cannot be any public comment after that public hearing is held and closed. Yeah. But there can certainly be commission discussion.
Okay. Well, we're pretty good at hashing things out, but once we finally are done, we're usually pretty quick at wrapping it up. Kim, you had a comment? But
the only thing about holding the public hearing on the 9th is I don't know that you've got sufficient time for noticing.
Oh. Is it, how many days is that, 10?
I believe it's
14.
Yeah, 14 or 15 days has to be noticed, and I don't think there'd be enough time.
We're not there.
Is it 26? No, we cannot hold it on the 9th. Okay. Not the public hearing.
All right.
Thank you.
But then next week, can we open another special?
On the 16th?
It's a holiday in Washington, D.C.
It is? What?
In Washington. Emancipation Day.
Yeah.
I'm fools.
My only concern is we have three, and I know one of them is going to have a lot of, I predict a lot of comments and a lot of time, and I think potentially three of them could, all three. So I don't know if you would want to, if there's some sort of approval that would need to be done for us to maybe have a special meeting on the 16th.
If we can get it posted in time. 16th.
Yeah, come out on the 2nd.
Can we post it?
I think the 16th would work. We get to
Isn't it posted on the website the night before? Because I thought we've had this discussion before. Does it actually have to be just in the printed form? I think the paper comes out the night before. Isn't it?
I think the printed form is one of two or three. I think the printed notice is mandatory. The primary newspaper circulation in the town.
Well, let me, if I may, commissioners, is there anybody that has a conflict on the 16th if we were to pursue that? No? I kind of do, but I can make it back. I will be out of town that day, but I can get back in time. It means getting out of here before 1 a.m. on that.
Is the 2nd Tuesday? Yeah. It is, right?
The
16th?
No, the 2nd.
The second is the first Monday. April 2nd is a Monday.
Which is a week from today, I believe.
It's a Monday.
The 26th.
It is. It's Monday.
Monday the
2nd.
Is it Monday the 2nd? Yes, it is.
I know because that is soccer
tournament. Yeah. And then so the 9th would be 14 days from tonight. So then
we would not be able to post
it. The 16th
would work if we get it out.
Would work if we wanted to do one more.
Maybe. Probably the published date is Wednesday.
Actually, it's
every
Tuesday.
Wednesday.
The monitor is Tuesday, yeah.
It's Tuesday. We get it at the
okay.
City Hall on Wednesdays, but Tuesdays
and is the question is...
Yeah, you get it in the mail, you get it Wednesday.
Next Tuesday is... What date?
If we do it tomorrow.
Well, that would be...
If we do it before this week.
That would be 13 days. It would have to be tomorrow. Which,
and no, it's too late to get it in there.
It's too late to get it in there tomorrow.
So. I don't think it'll make it for the 16th.
Right.
So
the 16th, we're not meeting in 15 days from the date that it's published.
Right. Okay. So unless we have to do it on the 23rd.
Unless we hold a special meeting, say on a Wednesday night or a Thursday night.
Yeah.
And rather than a Monday night.
But not a Tuesday night.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to try because I know that. I think with this project, I think we're real close, but It sounds like we're going to have to do it on the 23rd, so.
Sounds like it. Okay. We're really limited by the fact that Monterey publishes once a week, and we are really, by the code, the Monterey is the publication where it's supposed to be.
Yes, and then we can't have a meeting in May, because that'll be too late to meet the deadline for City Council to run all these through. Is that correct?
Well, the ultimate date was July 3rd. It's been pushed back to July 10th because of nobody wanted to hold a council meeting on the day before 4th of July. Mm-hmm. So, if we don't get through all of these, then it might potentially push back, 2 weeks, which is a possibility.
Okay, so I think we
just make these targets, but...
But there's another Monday on the 30th.
Right. Okay. So I was just thinking for a standard situation. So if we end up getting through two of them and the third one is pushing late at night, we could continue the public hearing for 2 weeks, and we're okay with that? I mean, is that something that's allowed? Or should we try to...
I don't... Sometimes I notice they continue the public hearing.
No, I don't think so.
We don't have to notice a continued public hearing, just the very first one. So we wouldn't have that same issue of 15 days.
So we could officially open the public hearing and then say it's continuing for,
say, four,
2 weeks, and then we have...
Or even to the 30th.
Yeah, if we did a special meeting. So 1 week or 2 weeks, then we would have all of the public testimony and then move on. Commissioner, do you have any input on that? Okay. I just see the 23rd is becoming very heavy.
I think so.
Yeah, okay. Well, so I guess we were asked if we had any comments on this. I don't know. Commissioners, any comments on this portion so far?
Are we commenting on the review criteria or the content of the amendment? Are you ready to move into comments on the...
Your pleasure.
Oh, I'm ready to keep rolling. Do you want to finish up your presentation?
Sure. The other parts had to do with the LOSA definition, and based on the last meeting we had, I think it's in here. Yes, this is based on the last meeting that we had, where we basically cut out a number of those specific uses, and I also have the permitted uses. You know, we had some discussion of this, and actually, I found a few mistakes in this, so this does not quite match what's in your written report.
Okay.
One of them being that cement manufacturing, processing, and mineral extraction were not a permitted use with a special use permit. It's also been reading the wrong column. And I think there were a couple of other minor, I think I missed accessory on warehouses. Warehouses are allowed. I think I used to have it as permanent, but it is permitted as an accessory use. And what the what I'm proposing is on the bottom left column, which is restaurant. Restaurant is currently permitted as an accessory use, as is retail, permitted as an accessory use. And I'm proposing, and motel is an accessory. Proposing that we may want to drop those as accessory and simply allow restaurant, retail, and delete pharmacy. It's a little hard to read in the red. Add hotel, motel. The only difference in the definition of those two in our code is that one hotel has meeting rooms. But also, I believe it also says that a motel may have meeting rooms. So there's, you know, a very minor distinction there. And a museum, and what I'm now calling a workshop facility was another term we came up with to try and address shop space, man cave, shop space, and not a dwelling unit, but a, you know, a living / entertainment area. Within the same space, same building. It could be automotive related, it could be aerospace related, it could be any number of things. As a catch-all for the, it's almost like an artist's studio and living unit. He said, well, here we're talking about a garage with not a living unit, but a space, not a dwelling unit. We don't want, at this point at least, to allow, a condominium that has a shop on the first floor and a living unit on the second floor. Not looking for that.
Okay. So, if I understand this correctly, the red is what you're proposing to remove, the yellow or orange is what you're proposing to add.
Correct.
And real quick on pharmacy, if I remember correctly, Dr. Havoc had, I thought, wanted that in there because of his practice. Is that no longer the case? Or
he did, and I spoke with Dan Rayner this afternoon. The reason that's in there is because, I think I forgot one. Okay. Is because in the past, I think is he retired now from his dental practice? He has had a very small pharmacy dispensary with his dental office. That's the reason that he wanted to keep that. But my thinking is that a small corner of the office pharmacy could be allowed under retail as a category, and it's really incidental to the office. I mean, professional offices are allowed, which would include medical offices. I don't see a need to explicitly permit pharmacy. You know, we don't want a Rite Aid or Walgreens out on the airport grounds.
Gotcha. So, just because pharmacy is not specifically allowed there anymore, he could in fact sell some pharmaceutical products as under retail umbrella? Is that?
That would be one way to interpret it, yeah.
So, pharmacy or Rite Aid wouldn't be retail?
They are a standalone pharmacy. Drugstore is a separate use in the zoning code. It's listed as a separate use. What I'm talking about is and perhaps the accessory designation is one way to actually keep the pharmacy, but I see that any pharmacy should be strictly be not an accessory, but in fact incidental to the office use.
Well, I don't see any conditional uses up there. Maybe we don't want to open that kind of worms. It could be. My concern is just to maintain, and maybe he doesn't have a desire for that, but I think if it's been allowed, I personally don't have a problem with it being there, either as an accessory or conditional use.
I was just wondering whether he could legally sell without a pharmacist permit. Most dentals don't sell you those, at least mine didn't. If I need something, we donate it.
Always.
I'm not sure he could sell it. Maybe have to give that in there.
Gotcha. Dave?
Is the pharmacy still there?
I don't know.
Is Dr. Havoc retired?
She said he was.
And the pharmacy was for his practice, which if it were to continue would be grandfathered use, would it not? Yeah. Regardless of what we do here.
True.
If it's discontinued, it isn't so much a question about Dr. Havoc, it's a question whether a pharmacy belongs in the LOSA or not.
Yeah. That would be if pharmacy were prohibited, it would potentially be a legal non-conforming use.
Excellent point.
That's for a grandfather.
Thank you.
Okay.
That's settled for me. Yeah. Any other?
That's a good
one. Dave?
Bridget? I just was going to ask, are you proposing to take off just the accessory use designation? That's why the A's are?
Right, right.
So you just want to make those okay, blanketly okay.
Yeah, the argument the debate I was having in my own head was, say for restaurant or retail, how do you define those as an accessory use? And you know, an accessory use is secondary to the principal use, which in this case is the airport. But how do you judge
But you don't want to take off restaurant and retail, you just want to take off the accessory provision. What about the coffee shop?
Might be helpful to just remove that accessory restriction. The coffee shop, I saw something different. A coffee shop is a pretty minor use, and I don't see a coffee shop being viable in the midst of the airport or in the airport property as a standalone serving the entire community coffee shop, like a Starbucks. A restaurant is a different scale and might potentially have a buzz in Snohomish, which serves the entire community. So, and it doesn't function really as an accessory to the party field. It's a standalone.
Then can I follow up?
Yes.
So taking the pharmacy designation out because we don't want to Rite Aid or Walgreens or whatever out there, how is that different than you have retail in there? You're going to try to control which retail stores belong out there? It just doesn't seem consistent to me. I just assume leave the pharmacy thing in there. I just don't understand the difference. A retail store, why wouldn't a Walgreens or a Rite Aid belong out there if that's what is viable out there? We're allowing retail. I don't know. It just doesn't seem consistent.
Dave?
I'd like to come back to Bridget's comment on that, but I'd like to start what I'm going to say is the beginning. I think the definition has made progress. I take my comment back, however, to the earlier comment that I made about we want to ensure the viability and protection of the airport, the airfield. That's what is this impetus behind this. And we've identified in the definition currently that it's to be a public, essential public facility with capacity for viable airport operations, providing aviation uses, operations services, as well as non-aviation uses. As I read that, it puts non-aviation uses on an equal footing with aviation uses. And it seems to me that it would be prudent to put some sort of clarifier in there, perhaps even as simple as where it says operations and services, and to a lesser extent, non-aviation uses. Something that would, first off, really help emphasize what the purpose of the LOSA is. It's first and foremost to support the air facility. And that then is going to lead into a comment on the accessory use, where down there, Paul, you define that accessory uses are those uses that are incidental and subordinate to the principal use. It might be said that the definition doesn't really fully clearly identify what the principal use is from the perspective that when we talk about, say, a retail store, if it's an accessory use to an airport, it's going to be retail that's largely aviation oriented, not pharmacy or Rite Aid or 7-Eleven or some other sort of retail. And while I appreciate, Bridget, your comment about allowing other things out there, do we really want the language to be flexible enough and broad enough to where it allows that potentially prominent of a non-aviation use to take up LOSA zone and designated space? Please.
I would clarify that what I'm saying is to say you don't want a Walgreens or a Rite Aid doesn't make sense when you're going to allow general retail without any sort of designation either. That's all I was saying. It doesn't seem consistent. I'm not in favor of necessarily having a Rite Aid out there, but it just didn't make sense to me.
And I agree with you in that. Then goes back to that principal use and the definition of making it very clear as to what is the principal use and purpose behind this. Paul, I think the direction you're going with most of the designation of the uses up here is fine. I do have a concern with one in particular, and that's dwelling single family. We've not talked at all about standards for single family dwellings in a LOSA zone. Is there going to be a minimum lot size that single family goes on? Is there going to be a limit as to how many single family dwellings can go on the LOSA designated in the zone property? Much of these other uses are fairly unique uses. You know, you talk about
a self-storage. Okay, it's a self-storage facility. It's got 50 sheds in there. Maybe they're going to go pot now if we go that direction, but perhaps not. But they are not uses that are going to be built again and again. And yet when we say a dwelling single family is an outright permitted use, I think that we are asking for trouble if we don't go in and define further what those standards are going to be for that sort of use. So just a word of hesitation on my part there. And I guess if we look at, say, a professional office, would our parking requirements for professional offices come in out of the parking ordinance and cover parking issues there?
They would.
Okay. So, again, just a very brief summary, a little more defining in the definition, a little bit more tying into a principal use, and then a little further analysis of what we need to have if we look at these specific types of uses that aren't currently addressed at all under a LOSA category in the zoning code.
Actually, I was tempted to delete the single family dwelling since it's a currently permitted use. There is a allowance for a caretaker or security person dwelling. And a temporary dwelling unit, in fact, there is no definition in the code for a temporary dwelling unit. That's another issue we'll have to deal with. But I was strongly tempted to take out dwelling single family. It's possible to build it within the requirements of 1860, the airport compatibility zone, but that begs the question, do we really wish to promote that at the airport?
And what he said was he wanted to consider having retail downstairs and condominium situation upstairs. Is that a single family dwelling?
Not a single family attached.
I'm just saying that he did specifically talk about.
That would
about
be an attached single family. Yeah, technically.
Okay, so is that different than?
That doesn't really say.
Okay, so well, I would want to keep that in mind because that was a.
So we were going to... No, my concern is there's currently a single-family dwelling.
Grandfathered in.
And I understand it would be grandfathered in, but my concern is back to the old, what if it burns down? Will the operator, current and probable future operator of the airport owner, want to live on that property? And if so, will they want to maybe build a new home in its current location?
Well, that's the only reason I kept it in there was because I thought, well, you know, I don't think in Harvey Field, you know, they have the old the house there. And I didn't realize that there was a house here at this airport, but since it would be a legal, non-conforming use, and without checking the code, I would make a judgment that if it burns down, it could be rebuilt as a legal non-conforming use, not an illegal non-conforming use.
Well, what if he wants to tear it down and rebuild it because he feels it's getting old in 15 years from now, but the operator still wants to live on his property? Does that being taken out still allow him to do that?
This conforming, non-conforming gets complicated. I know it came up on the West Main Corridor with council, and the end result was that we start out with being able to rebuild a single family home within its original footprint, and then we came back as recently and you know, flexed the side yard setbacks and removed that requirement that it be within the original footprint, but it could be rebuilt.
Maybe I shouldn't have brought up the house burned down in that situation. I guess my thought is, you know, if this is going to be viable for a long time, if we're looking at this being something that's going to be here for another 25 years or longer, and whoever owns this property likes living next to the airport, likes having their own little personal hangar, but they decide, you know, this house is just getting too old, I want to update, I want to, you know, something that's bigger so the grandkids can come over, are they going to be able to do that? with that being taken out. And so that's my thought of having it in there. I know Dave's dying to jump in here, but that's kind of where I'm going. Is my concern is for at least having it available one single dwelling, nothing else. Dave?
You went where I was going to go. The LOS is not a residential zone. Put a footnote on the dwelling single family, one within the zone. And if they want to tear down what they have, they remove that, convert it to offices, and build a house on the 10 acres to the north that's part of the LOSA zone, let them build their house up there and they can live there. But just put a footnote on one in the entire zone. If they turn further subdivide or they have multiple lots and they want to have another house and they have to come back and get a redesignated or something. But again, the LOSA is not intended to be a residential zone.
Right.
I think an owner, manager, whatever you want to call it, house is great. I don't have a problem with that. I think Harvey Field's a great example of that. But let's not open up the door for 4 or 5 or 8 or 10 houses on small lots on the north part. If they want to do that, they should have a residential designation as part of the property.
Great. Great. Yeah.
There's 3 homes within the zone that is still drawn away. It's drawn originally. Here, here, and here. So we just have to make sure we accommodate that back.
Is that right?
Sure.
There's actually a 4th. There's also a mobile home. It's on the property that's being used as the flight office. And
that's right.
And so, thank you, Kevin. Is that considered and also a dwelling right now? Or is it just basically a mobile home that's an office?
It was.
So potentially there's 3 different families living, I guess you could say, on
4.
This. 4, pardon me, thank you. 4 different families living on this, in this particular zone.
Is there someone living in the whole flight office?
There is.
Okay. Commissioners, I am of the opinion that I really don't want to put the current condition that they have in as personally, I don't want to create a jeopardy situation for them, but I do want to make sure that somebody in the future doesn't decide they want to convert this over to a neighborhood if that isn't really the intent. And so, staff, I don't know if you have any recommendations on how to address that. Or any other commissioners? Or other staff? Mark?
Well, if it pleases the board, I have the non-conforming chapter in front of me. I could read you a little bit out of non-conforming structures, 18.72050. Are you interested in that?
I guess sure, that shed some light.
I guess having read it, it would be my opinion that the structures that are there are fairly protected in terms of, but I'll read it to you and let you decide for yourself. Again, this is 18.72050, non-conforming structures. Where a lawful structure exists at the effective date of adoption of the ordinance codified in this title, that could not be built under the terms of this title by reason of restrictions on area, lot coverage, height, yards, or other characteristics of the structure, it may be continued, so that's just saying, it may be continued as the structure remains otherwise lawful, subject to the following provisions. So that's your grandfathering. It's allowed to remain there. And then A says, no such structure may be enlarged or altered in a way which increases its degree of nonconformity. Alterations, additions, or enlargements may be allowed as long as the work done does not further extend in any required yard, that would be, you know, your setbacks, or violate any other portion of this code. There's some other language in here. And then there's the the famous, should the structure be destroyed by any means to an extent of more than 50% of its replacement cost at the time of destruction, it shall not be reconstructed except in conformity with the provision of this title. So, by that standard, if you have a small fire, you can rebuild it back just how it was. If you have a big fire, technically you probably can't rebuild it, and we'd be in a situation at that time where we'd have to make some decision about whether they could rebuild that. Does that help?
It does for me.
Yeah.
Back to the footnote comment then. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Sure.
Maybe we just make a footnote that says four dwelling units may be allowed, no more than four at any one time or something like that.
And we could make a comment regarding the legally non-conforming use for the existing houses, but no new single-family detached residences will be allowed, or no additional single-family residences will be allowed.
And I would agree with that, except on my scenario that I'm making up. 15 years from now, somebody decides they want to, you know what, I like this house, but I really, you know, it's a mobile, I want to build something else instead here, a little Rambler, or this Rambler I have just is getting old and I want to rebuild. And would that be allowed under that type of...
That footnote could be crafted so that the rebuilding is not restricted to the original footprint. Or we don't restrict removing and replacing.
Okay. That's where
it protects the existing home and protects my right to be able to build or rebuild that house.
Demolish or rebuild a modern house to current codes and those kind of things.
Right.
Commissioners, any input on that?
And that would apply on any of the existing residents you're suggesting?
That was my suggestion.
I'm sorry?
Well, if you're saying that Paul's suggestion of them being legal non-conforming?
I think that's where we're going. The current dwelling units, all four, would be legal non-conforming and could be rebuilt. That was my...
I think we had a discussion about that some weeks ago, if I remember right, that had some mixed opinions on it. But I guess my concern would be, first off, are we taking something away from a property owner here by what we're proposing to do? Are they under common ownership of the airport now? And perhaps Mr. Donovan, Kevin can answer that question.
I can, actually. So three of the properties are under common ownership of Dr. Havoc, and the fourth property, which is directly north of the main residence, which is located on 179th. That is, I think the last name of that owner is Harris. I don't remember, but I think it's Harris. And they, you know, that could be a big deal to them. But I've never spoken with that family. I've never met them. But that could be a big deal to them. So.
And that is currently in the Velosa now. So anything we do here would affect that property owner.
Yeah. Another twist. We permit dwelling single family, and we footnote that to say, in some fashion, existing single family homes are allowed. They would not be non-conforming in any sense. And then to add to that a clause that no additional new homes can be built. No additional new single-family detached residences are allowed. So we have four. We'll keep the four, but we don't want to promote more of the same.
Existing
are allowed. Restrictions to those four.
Okay. So it'd be something like the existing are allowed outright, and no additional may be developed.
Right. In so many words.
Is there any problem? Jeff?
The two northeast from those properties have residences on them, but they're larger lots. So there's excess land, and of all land inside the designated area, that is some of the most utilitarian land in regards to being away from what's going to be very extensive critical areas. And we saw from East Monroe that by the time it gets all hacked up by these overly cumbersome critical area setbacks.
Is that an editorial comment, Mr. Sherwood?
They may have been. Those properties are probably, they're either going to be redeveloped or developed further down the road. If they're, say, 80,000 square feet and they're worth $10 a square foot, you know, it may be $800,000 worth of property. Let's say $5, it's $400,000. And as homes, their values are unlikely to reach that level. As a result, there will be an impetus for redevelopment of those properties as they contain the most utilitarian area within the designated LOSA boundary. So I think the market here, in regards to a lot of things we've already talked about, is going to take care of a lot of this single family issue, as well as other issues. There is essentially no retail within a half a mile of this of any significance, maybe a mile, maybe the ARCO is the closest. So the chances that some invasive large-scale retail is going to end up on this property is extremely minimal, because almost invariably isolated retail fails. I think we have to trust the market here a little bit, that the market is going to solve a lot of the issues that we're talking about. And so I don't think we have to overly concern ourselves with nitpicking about uses that are specific, because if you have a $400,000 lot, most don't want to put a house on it anyways. They're going to want to put something that earns more dough than the house would. So I just want, you know, I just want to put that perspective out there on this, that if it is going to be viable as an airport property, as well as other uses, and what we're trying to do here is by encouraging the airport to exist, it has to be financially feasible. Why is Darryl moving on? Because he's had to pump money into this thing for many, many years. And we're trying to make a setting where there's a balance between keeping the airport, but not making it so financially cumbersome to a potential owner by allowing other uses to help support it. That's the way I wrap my head around this, you know, this thing. I felt like that's where we were going before, and so I hope we can stay on track.
So if I may, just to make sure I understand what you're saying, well, I got two questions. One is, are you maybe suggesting that we not even take out the single-family dwelling because really the market's not going to be driving that? And I guess the second question I would have is, if the Planning Commission isn't, the majority of the Planning Commission isn't comfortable with that, are you opposed to the footnote previously suggested?
No, I think that's fine. If this thing doesn't happen for a little while, then that serves those folks, saying you have all these rights that you should have in regards to where you live. So I completely agree with you.
Thank you. Dave?
Recognizing that Jeff's comment about the market, and the airport is thriving, then the highest and best use will be more valuable land than what residential would support or require. And I can certainly see where those lots might be reduced down, and yet the houses preserved. Is there any need for any concern on this commission's part or our ordinance as far as a minimum lot size for the residential tracts or parcels?
Jeff?
Does everybody within the LOSA area have sanitary sewer service available?
It's available on 179th, but not everybody is tapped into it, so there are quite a few subjects there. But the sanitary sewer is on 179th, it's high pressure, so it would be expensive to hook into it. So unless they really need to, they're just going to continue to use their septic.
Okay. So that's going to speak to the issue of minimum lot size.
Thank you, Kevin. Mark?
Just for information, the current density allowed on the LOSA, or minimum lot size, is one unit per 2 acres. So you're not going to get a very high density residential situation.
Great, so that
at that rate.
Well, it won't change anything then.
It's already in there.
Okay, thank you. Dave?
I might suggest that the applicant might not like that. They might think it's too big. They might want to take some of that land for other uses besides residential. Certainly you don't need 2 acres for a house and a septic system.
Jeff?
I certainly could see, I mean, we need to make some provision for especially those north two lots and maybe even one where Daryl's house is, that those lot lines can be moved up, leave lots that are large enough to support the home and the septic system, and allow the excess land to be developed otherwise. There is the issue of the gas line in there, but you know, providing some flexibility so that the usable land can be used.
I think if yeah, putting in some sort of other use than residential is desirable. I think the applicant at that point, if it becomes that necessary, come and try to get some things modified. I don't know, do we want to delve into modifying the setbacks or the minimum lot requirements at this point? Just roll with it.
I would say no. I mean, Jeff, I think you made some good points, that, and I agree that the single family detached dwellings for the general population are not long lived for this property, should it develop as we hope it will. I think the market will address that. Another aspect of it is that there's a limited amount of area where you can accommodate non-aviation uses. I mean, that rectangle going west of the airport, which is in the county, is zoned general commercial in the county. So the only restriction there has to do with the compatibility zones, zone 2, which does not allow very much in terms of people.
Down on the water also.
The eastern end of that northeast area may be an excellent spot for some kind of redevelopment for, you know, non-aviation uses, but not large lot single family residential.
Dave?
So are we circling back to Paul? Are you suggesting such redevelopment should be just allowed from the get-go under the LOSA, or if that were to occur, should that be addressed later on under modification of the LOSA as it comes out here?
Well, if we allow, say, the use we're talking about within LOSA, I'm not sure I understand your question.
So you talk about it perhaps being suitable for redevelopment of non-aviation uses, but those non-aviation uses be limited to what's on the list that's being proposed, or something else?
No, I'm talking about what's on the list as a permitted use in LOSA.
And there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 of those things. Looking at the printed list, it might be a little different out there. The rest all being accessory, to what I understand, is supposed to be the principal use, which is supposed to be aviation-oriented.
Yes.
Okay. I guess I don't see the room for redevelopment in a different direction, non-aviation direction, under what we have in front of us here tonight.
Oh, well, we have professional office, potentially restaurant, potentially retail, hotel, motel.
Hotel, motel shown as an accessory.
But I'm suggesting that the accessory be deleted.
Yeah.
Okay.
That it be a fully permitted use. And the restaurant retail be fully permitted, not as only as accessory uses. So that gives us professional office, restaurant retail, pharmacy is in there in red, hotel, motel, workshop, museum, as a bundle of uses. I mean, you can extract a number of different specific things out of those uses, but That would seem to be a pretty good plate for redevelopment possibilities in this location, in the airport.
So if I may, we've gone around in a big circle, and I think we're, in my mind, quite frankly, I've settled with what I see here as being removed and being added and not being modified. I personally feel comfortable with. Is there anything we're desiring to change? And we talked about a footnote and changing that dwelling single family, as far as I'm concerned. After further discussion, I'm personally comfortable leaving it in. Jeff, anything you would want to change on this list?
Well, I just have a question. The printout of the PDF that I have has parking in red crossed out, but I see that it's
right
stored here.
That's the difference between the two. Originally thinking was, well, parking is going to be required with any sort of use. Build an office building, you build a museum, a bed and breakfast, you're going to have parking. Well, what's this to mean? But as it turns out, that during, say, the fair, there are a number of people that use the airport grounds for parking as a single-purpose use, or temporary, but for parking. So it's not parking that's associated with the restroom. It's associated with the airport by default, consumers for the fairgrounds. So I decided this is the only place.
Okay.
As it stands.
Because I think that, especially in the interim, that it should be kept in, probably not even as an accessory use necessarily, because it's going to make some dough for whoever owns the property.
And that's what it does now.
And it can help it be viable. This is why Snohomish County bought Hansen's property, is for parking revenue. So it is substantial. It's significant as cash. It comes all at once. So I think it would be a desirable thing to keep in. And it wouldn't be an accessory use if you were talking about fairground parking, that's all.
So, Paul, then this list that we see on the screen is your actual final list versus what we have in print. And
yes, there's some minor differences.
With that, Jeff, if I may, the only change you're proposing then to this list on the screen is getting rid of accessory for parking?
Yeah, because if you interpreted that strictly, then you couldn't use it for parking before the fair.
Okay. Dave, anything on that list?
No, I am curious whether there is anyone else that shares my concern over my comments on the definition itself. We kind of moved on past that.
Right. No, I agree we should go back. I'd like to, if we may, just quickly go through this zoning and then go back to definition, if we may. I personally don't have a problem with this list, nor do I have a problem with taking away accessory from parking. Wayne?
I have no problem.
Bridget?
No problem.
So, Paul, did we give you a good answer on that list then?
Yes, I think so.
All right. Thank you. And yeah, I think you do need to go back to the definition. Adding a note for the as well as non-aviation uses. Could you repeat what it was you wanted to add there?
My comment pertained to the bundling, so to speak, of the non-aviation uses along with other uses of the airport that are perhaps aviation related, and not drawing a distinction between the aviation and non-aviation, to put emphasis on the fact that the purpose of this LOSA is to protect the airport. And my comment then in turn ties into, when we look at the language of the accessory use, when we talk about incidental subordinate to the principal use, it would just, in my mind, it further helps define what that principal use is. And I suggested that perhaps even some simple languages where in the second line says operations and services, and to a lesser extent, non-aviation uses, or something to that effect, just to distinguish between principal and secondary.
Mm-hmm. And if I may throw out maybe a possible variation on the same concept, one thing I thought, that last sentence, the designation shall protect the airport from incompatible uses and developments, to sustain its long-term viability, and I've always felt that viability just kind of dropped off the cliff there. Its long-term viability as an operating airport, does that cover that, or is that just muddy the water even further? Quite frankly, I'm comfortable with Dave's suggestion.
I'd be comfortable with both.
Jeff's an air redundancy or nothing.
I was thinking one or the other is what I was thinking.
The first line pretty well covers our field.
Yeah, it does. Bridget?
So I have a question about shall. I just don't like the sentence at all, because I don't understand how the designation, what enforcement power does it have to protect the airport from incompatible uses? I don't know, it's come up in other situations where now we've had to address what somebody intended in writing many years ago, and then it just seems like we're obligated by using that word. I don't know, and it just bothers me as an English nerd.
Okay, as a reminder, I think we all are aware, we're dealing with the comprehensive plan definition, and then we were dealing with the zoning designation. So I think the most recent desire is to keep this not too specific, but defined enough to lay out a goal, a purpose, if I understand correctly. I personally don't have a problem with the shop protect. I understand where you're coming from with it. It does seem policy oriented or restrictive, but
it does have a bit of a regulatory taste. So we here's a simple suggestion: say should rather than shall.
I only bring that up because it's come up and it's been a source of hours of conversation. But that's not what people meant. So
should reinforces that the intent of this is to do.
Yeah, I love that.
This protection.
So could it be something like the intent of this designation is to protect the airport from incompatible uses and developments and to sustain its long-term viability?
Just leave chapter out or
should.
Or should put should. Put should in there, maybe that's what.
Sorry, can you repeat that again? Or? How I see it is the intent of this designation is to protect the airport from incompatible uses and developments and to sustain its long-term viability. Dave?
I can certainly go along with that. I still think it would be good to draw the distinction between principle and non-principle.
And I agree. Jeff, do you have a comment?
Is it okay for me to ask a question of someone who's out there?
Absolutely.
Yes. Is there a deal going down that is going to significantly alter what's going on here?
No. Okay. I mean, there is a pending sale, and as you know, since you're an appraiser, that not every deal closes. But I haven't heard anything today that's going to affect the current sale that we have.
Okay.
Yeah, so
I just want to make sure we're going to have to revisit this as a result of an event to occur.
No. The event that may occur, I don't think it's going to make any of this move. So
thank you.
Thank you. So, go ahead, Paul.
I will add a phrase that defines as the airport as the principal use.
Great.
As part of this definition.
Excellent.
Okay.
Thank you. I think we got that covered. So, commissioners, are we good with the definition?
Sounds great.
Excellent. And we haven't let you quite finish your. Is that the end?
It's the end.
Goodness. Well. Looking at the clock, I see it's 9:01. We do need to make a motion to extend the meeting beyond 9:00. So I would entertain a motion that we extend the meeting beyond 9:00.
I'll make a motion to extend the meeting past 9:00.
Second. Motion made by Commissioner Demarest, seconded by Commissioner Rodman. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. So, go ahead, Paul.
May I suggest a 5-minute break? And then we can, since this is our first exposure to North Cal, so we can
we
go through a lot of material.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Consider between now and the next one.
Could I, real quick, is there anybody in the audience who wants to make any further comments on this?
Yeah.
I'm assuming not. Let's take a 5-minute break.
Okay, we are on our third workshop of the evening. This is CPA 2012B. Kim, I'm sorry, you already I assume. Thank you. North Kelsey and Downtown Plan Update. And I believe this is also Planning Manager Pokalka, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
This is my last one for tonight.
Okay.
We talked about this in our last, I think, our last meeting. Maybe it was 2 meetings ago. But just as a real brief update, the intent here is to repeal the North Kelsey plan and the downtown plans from the comprehensive plan, but as an intern action to add some supporting goals and policies back into that comprehensive plan that will set the framework for these two standalone plans. But what I have tonight is some suggested goals and policies to feed the North Kelsey plan back into the comprehensive plan. I do not have downtown. I'll bring that next time after I've had some more time to get with some of the downtown folks. But what this is about, this was the concept plan that was done as part of the plan back in 2000. When was it? 2001, 2002?
Three.
2003. And, the way that this has developed, it simply renders this concept plan pretty much undoable, unattainable for the most part. If you look at an aerial photograph, you got Lowe's, Walmart to the north, and potentially at least very strong connection for NextCor coming in west of the Lowe's, which does not leave a tremendous amount of property up in this North Kelsey area. So the die is somewhat cast. But in response to trying to deal with how to keep a good presence in the comp plan, I started with there is currently one goal and one policy in the comp plan. And my suggestion here is that the goal simply be revised to delete that phrase "and civic town," so that it reads, "will provide a visible and accessible commercial center." The intent being that the civic gathering place aspect of this not be in North Kelsey but be in the downtown area, and that the single land use policy that's in the comp plan now, I've kept that in place, but I'd like to just reference the North Kelsey plan, not the downtown area, because that's a separate, I'm going to bring that in as a separate set of goals and policies. So that's the current. So based on, I don't think you can copy this, but this is from the North Kelsey plan. There are two pages of goals and objectives. What I have done is take these six goals, and each goal has an objective or a number of objectives narrated in a paragraph form, and converted that. So the first goal in North Kelsey is increase the city's economic vitality. So I changed that to an objective, which the objective is simply about allowing for a variety of commercial uses. And it does say including big box, as long as they're designed to meet other plan objectives. Well, I don't think we need to specifically say big box. And we have already said that the designs will, with the previous policy, that the designs will be in accordance with the design guidelines. and also said that the north site should support the city's tax base. Well, I condensed that down to the meat of it, which is increase vitality really by allowing a variety of commercial uses. That's implicit in the language that I have not included. The second goal is to create a focal point as a community gathering spot. That's that civic place, that village green that's been a part of this plan that we want to take out of the North Kelsey and build it downtown. So I've just eliminated this goal. It called for a plaza that would accommodate 1,000 people, a variety of events and uses, safe and welcoming, casual, comfortable, and a modest water feature. This kind of a civic place, in my mind, should be downtown. That's where the heart of the community is. We can't have two. And part of this process is that in the city of, 17, 18,000, you really can't support a downtown-scale North Kelsey plan that's pedestrian-oriented with a lot of smaller uses and preserve your downtown. That's the inherent fault of this, I think, is that there's a lot of language about North Kelsey not competing and contrasting the downtown, but in fact, it does, by its own intent and its own admission, compete with downtown. It replicates it. So, I've eliminated that goal. The third one, provide for uses and services that meet the needs of Monroe's diverse population. And I have taken language out of that objective under the goal, and the goal, provide the needs and services, by encouraging, as it says in the objective here, a variety of commercial uses that serve local and regional. What I have cut is most of the language in this Goal 3 related objective talks about a community center to serve recreation, social, cultural, educational for young folks, old folks, housing, and so forth. And that community center is not a viable part of the North Kelsey Planning Board. It may be a good idea in the first place, but the Y has been built elsewhere, the skate park has been built elsewhere. It's lost its, I guess, viability for a community center. And in fact, in a perfect world, I would put a community center downtown by choice rather than North Kelsey, just to invigorate the downtown. But nonetheless, we do keep that goal in hand because we do want to provide those kinds of services. And we've got a couple more here. The fourth goal, create a strong identity for the development. Absolutely. And I basically repeated virtually everything in this from the original plan. The architectural design, modern and traditional elements, emphasizing landscaping, greenery, incorporating public art. What I dropped from the North Kelsey is create a park-like setting. Not appropriate for North Kelsey. Not in the mode that it's being developed. I didn't think that had any value. The next one, I'll go through these fairly quickly, maybe we can come back. Goal 5, convert that to land use policy number 2.5. The goal is encourage pedestrian-friendly development. Now, I've kept this in place only because, you know, we're not trying to build a, in its totality, a pedestrian-friendly commercial center. It's auto-dependent, auto-centric. But by the same token, we don't want to discourage the pedestrian environment. So we pick the most important parts of what was in that objective, which are pedestrian connections between uses. I have not included encouraged small-scale businesses such as cafes and specialty shops. That, to me, is downtown-related. Encourage building design that orients to public open space, pathways, and streets. That's not in North Kelsey. But I have included developing streets with pedestrian amenities, separating peds and vehicles, where possible, along arterials, even if it's in a linear sense where the sidewalk is not right next to the curb, like say along Main Street in some cases. Bicycle access, parking lot screening, trying to tone down that automotive environment, the presence of the car, both in terms of moving traffic and the parking lots, and encouraging large-scale uses to provide, you know, more than one entry and minimizing those blank walls. What I have dropped is provide pedestrian-oriented plazas and open spaces throughout the development. That a lot of those things are related back to this plan. This plan is a series of walkable pedestrian spaces. It's a shopping mall turned inside out. And that was a pedestrian spine all the way through this. And that's really what they're referring to here in the original plan. So back to this one about keeping the best parts of that, building a pedestrian-friendly environment. Don't ignore the pedestrian. I mean, the car is king, but do what we can to minimize the impact to the pedestrians that are there. And the last one is the goal in the Kelsey plan is create a place that complements but does not reproduce the aesthetics of the downtown commercial corridor. So what I've done here is to take the objective and turn that goal statement into the first sentence of the objective, and you do that by, and it's almost a direct quote, enhancing the connections between the site, in this case being North Kelsey, and downtown. I think that's a fairly elusive connection, but nonetheless, I think there should be some implication of the connection between the two areas. Providing uses, activities, and that overall site character that contrasts rather than copies downtown. And another way of saying, let it be the auto-centric environment that is very much in contrast to the pedestrian environment downtown. That's sort of the intent of this. So that, very briefly, is what I'm suggesting, first draft for taking the goals and objectives, the direction from the North Kelsey plan, and getting it back into the comp plan explicitly in the goals and objectives, and then doing the same with the downtown plan. But that's the downtown does not have the benefit that North Kelsey had in the comp plan. There's no goal related strictly to downtown. It's not there. No goal, no objectives, no policies. So that's something that needs to be put together. And in terms of the plan itself, what it's all about is Chapter 1 is Introduction of Purpose. Chapter 2 is Market Analysis. The part that is most inappropriate at this point is Chapter 3, the Development Concept. That entire chapter is basically history. But we are keeping the design guidelines intact. There may be we may want to consider some tweaking of the design guidelines. I know some people had problems with the sign code that's within the North Kelsey design guidelines. But they are in the zoning code now. They are part of the zoning code regulations, so they are there. They will remain there. Same with the downtown guidelines that are actually by reference or standards, not guidelines, although they're written as guidelines. But nonetheless, all those design directions are embedded in the zoning code, so we're not abandoning those. I think there's some misconception out there that we're throwing out the baby and the bathwater. Not the case. So with that, let me throw it back to Mr. Chair, to the commission, and get some feedback.
Great, thank you. Commissioners, comments on these revisions and goals?
That's a lot of information.
I'll throw some out there. On converting North Kelsey goal number 4 to policy 2.4, I don't have a problem with public art necessarily. Could this be construed as somebody wanting to mandate public art? I mean, is that loose enough that it's...
The wording is in the plan, just shortened up, was to encourage the involvement of the artist in public improvement projects, like streets and so forth. And in my experience, in the both public and private projects that I've been involved with, when there was an artist involved, it brought a huge dimension to the project, and it made it so much better than it otherwise would have been without that energy from that direction. So, but that was related to public art. And we don't have any requirement for public art. Of course, I think it'd be a great idea, but we don't have that sort of requirement for public or private projects.
Great.
Yeah. Did the incorporation of the public art cost a lot more dough?
No, it's both. It's not. It may not be public art per se, but the artist may have. I mean, public art can be anything from a plop art, an object, a sculpture. Or it could be the pattern in the sidewalk, and any number of things. It doesn't mean that it's a standalone work that costs a lot more money than you would otherwise spend.
I walk around Lake Tai, and quite frankly, I don't get it. It looks expensive.
That was hard.
Yeah. It was donated.
Signaling, paid for.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then that's okay.
I've seen a lot of public art applied to sidewalks, walls, murals.
We have those tiles. We have.
Right. Sort of a lot of ceramic work. I've done a lot of, or seen a lot of ceramic murals that were put in place. But it did, like I say, it could be something as easy as a scoring pattern in the concrete sidewalk. There's just one example. We did a downtown project that we used concrete pavers, and the railroad was the driving history of this town, and the sidewalk pattern was set up in terms of rails and switches in terms of the pattern, and there were some other things that were done to reflect that railroad heritage that were basically come up with by this artist, and it gave it a whole different dimension. But it's not meant to be an encumbrance of any sort, or a oh my god, we have to do this kind of effort.
Yeah, I when traveling in other areas of the country, in other cities, one thing I appreciate that they do is they when they build their forms, they put an artistic pattern in it, and they use colored concrete at times. Mm-hmm. To me, that's an inexpensive way to really decorate a big concrete bridge. But my thought is emphasizing landscaping and greenery, and possibly incorporating public art, or I don't know. To me, it almost, and maybe I'm focusing on this way more than I should. It just seems, it comes across a little bit as a mandate, but that's just my perspective. Bill?
I'm glad you brought this up, because of the public art thing. One person's art is not so much another person's art. If you consider tagging, some tagging are beautiful works of art, but they're not applicable. So I think having a definition of what public art encapsulates, I think that would be important to have.
Well, here's the actual statement from the North Kelsey plan, which is part of the objective of the goal. This last sentence, employ local artists where possible in the design of public spaces and the streetscape.
Let's just put that back in there.
I took that as public art.
So, Wayne?
Yes, over the years I've talked to many people coming into the role, and the thing that impresses them the most is our the media, the flowers and the lawns. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when I brought my wife to Washington to visit my folks, we came through Duval and Monroe, and the first time we hit the park out here, or the media, she was commenting what a beautiful town is, and right there. So not knowing we were going to live here, you know, at that time. But, but so many people have mentioned that. If we can kind of keep that going, I noticed a lot of the other tenants, snow only started following our way of doing that too. And on their Pickford Avenue, I think it is, that they started doing that. Mm-hmm. And kind of following our way of doing it. So I would say that I would go along with more than the sculptures.
Well, you know, in actuality, the landscaping and the art of landscape design, as in the beads and so forth, is a form of public art.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. It can be anything, but it's it does, that word does have some phrase may have some baggage. So yeah. I can revise it to reflect closer to what was said in the North Kelsey plan.
Yeah, and I think I agree with the sentiment that much of the North Kelsey plan, and it's unfortunate for the amount of work that was put in by the public. Much of the North Kelsey plan is really unachievable, I think, at this point. And I guess, you know, what it originally was going to be, I guess you could say, is the Mill Creek model, and I could really see somebody using a local artist to incorporate those things. And I think how it's going now, it is more a matter of medians with, you know, attractive streetscaping, I guess, is what I would refer it to. But that was just my... Any other comments? Dave?
Paul, you say that this is being done, and Paul Lutz was just commenting about how the plan that was envisioned isn't achievable. The opportunity for that is past. It's not going to happen. So we are, in fact, minimizing, perhaps, what was in that plan, trying to pull out what was important in some respects and preserve that just in a different packaging, so to speak. How does the Walmart site plan measure up to these standards as they're now proposed? Given that Walmart will be the major, it will be the anchor tenant of this entire area.
A couple of quick thoughts on that.
Could I answer that real quick? That is controlled by a development agreement that's already been established under a contract.
So, I understand.
So anything we did changing it wouldn't modify that.
Well,
in any way. So I just wanted to share that little piece.
And I understand that, and thank you for that clarification. But I'm just curious, how does it stand up or measure up to these standards that are being proposed, given that it is such a major player in that area? Or are we just looking at almost adopting, and I hate to say this, but token language out of there to try to satisfy some folks, perhaps, when in reality, it's not achievable either, because most of the property, most of the area is already either developed or under a developer's agreement that's going to allow it to go some other direction. I'm curious.
Go ahead.
Okay. I think that what we're saying is it's a goal, and so I think it's great to set that goal, and whether or not you can accurately achieve. It's something to work towards, and so I think taking it away or decreasing it, I actually like the language that you read. Probably think it's more inclusive, but there's an idea that we want to have out there. And as far as the Walmart goes, they did try, not up to my personal satisfaction, but they did incorporate the mixed materials and the greenery, and you know, we told them how many flower pots they have to have and benches and that kind of stuff. And then Lowe's has the same thing. It has, you know, a variety of architectural uses, and that doesn't mean that we should. I think that is throwing out the baby with the bathwater to say that we're just not going to say it because we haven't been able to achieve it necessarily. Yeah, but it's a goal to have, and I think it's a good goal to have, and it's a goal that people wanted to have. So I like having that goal.
And I think that sounds very nice. That is meaningful. And I just asked a simple question of how a Walmart site plan would measure up these standards, or is it going to be a set of standards that, you know, nothing really up there meets and probably won't meet. It just, all I did was ask a question. And not trying to change Walmart or saying it's not right or wrong or that it should be done differently, recognizing that that's history to some extent at this point. I'm just curious as to how, given that it's such a big player in this area, how it fits in with these criteria.
Yeah, I agree with asking the question, because if we're taking language that we know is unachievable, a lot of it, and trying to condense it, and if we still try to incorporate what we can out of it and realize, well, you know, do we need to come back and redo this when we start to see that, well, it doesn't quite fit what's there. I think it probably does fit what's there. I haven't looked at the plan, but I think if I look at Lowe's as an example, I could see Lowe's fitting within this, maybe not the public art. I don't see me out there, but I think Lowe's, you could argue that Lowe's fits that goal, and I'm guessing that Walmart probably does too. And I think it's okay to ask, and I think the question is yes, I think it covers my perspective.
And I'm not talking just with regard to this one
proposed
policy. I'm talking to the discussion of all.
Right. So that one was the only one. Go ahead.
I'd like to say also that I think having the goals there keeps that in the front. And I understand you asking a question, but you gotta still stand up and say, this is what our goals are. We have to keep aiming at that target. You know, if we take the target down and we make it bigger or smaller or whatever, then we're just defeating the whole purpose of having, you know, goals or rules or policies or anything. We have to have something that we can aim at. This is our target.
Well, and I know that it does, it wants to just sound nice, but, you know, the first presentation of the site plan looked one way, and because of what was listed there and what we had asked for as a goal or as a North Kelsey plan, some things had to be changed, and it is influential. It's not just putting words up there. And I know you're just asking a question, but I'm saying I pontificated on that for a long, long, long time, and many sleepless nights, and researching and trying to evaluate, you know, what doesn't feel right, what doesn't jive with a particular site plan and what was listed as a goal. And we need to keep those goals. And I don't, the artwork thing, I mean, I understand what Paul is saying. I think we all do. Yeah, let's have the concrete look prettier. Let's have a mural painted somewhere. I don't know. I just think they're good goals to have, and I would hate to just throw out the North Kelsey plan as a complete loss and not try and take what we can salvage. And there's a lot. I mean, Walmart is a big player up there, but there's a lot left to be developed, and I don't want to see that be a free-for-all either. Let's try to have them meet goals that we have set. That's all.
I only had one other thing, and that is on converting North Kelsey goal number 6 to policy 2.6. That last sentence, you know, it says, and site design character that contrasts rather than copies downtown. And I just kind of, I don't know if contrast is the right word.
It's right on the Kelsey plan.
Well, I know it is. And, you know, I don't want to fix something that ain't broken, but to me it seems like it would be more that complements, or, you know, we don't want it to look the same, but we don't want it to be so conflicting that we have, you know, North Kelsey looks like downtown Seattle and downtown Monroe looks like downtown Monroe. But anyway, that's just something I threw out there. It just seemed a little odd. I also thought you mentioned having a community area. I know it's been discussed, and I I've expressed my opinion on this before. I think when North Kelsey was originally hammered out, I think a lot of people thought of that being a great thing, and I don't disagree with that, considering that we're not, unfortunately, able to achieve that in North Kelsey. I don't recall it being a big goal in downtown. I guess we could say, what do we want downtown to look like? Do we want it to look like, say, Leavenworth? Leavenworth has a community center for big events and those kinds of things that's a draw. But I also look at Old Town Snohomish, though, part of that. That really doesn't have a center that I can call out necessarily. But it seems to me like a very viable part of town. I mean, the economy's been a little rough on it lately. But I still, when I head over there, there's still a lot of activity in there. And to me, there's no public facility. And I'm just questioning, you are going to talk to the folks downtown, and that's one thing I would really like to hear from them, if that's a big goal for them. If it is, then let's run down that road. But if it's not, you know, maybe something else is more important to them. So,
the downtown plan is what's the technical name, or what's really termed as a festival lot. It could be a multi-purpose area that, you know, may be a parking lot in its simplest sense. But I construe that to mean that when you couple that concept with the Village Green concept from North Kelsey and trying to bring that downtown, is a civic plaza gathering space, a memorable space where people can come together. And when Snohomish, there's a very small area where they have music and so forth during the blues festival and so forth. But something along that vein that's maybe in a larger size, that is a central point that everything gravitates toward and from, sure, that focal point. Yeah. And that's the intent.
Okay.
I think in this plan, the Village Green may have been in the center part, where it may have been another version of it up at the upward end with looks like a small pond. But I have some hope that with this NextCorp project, we're not sure exactly how they're envisioning that building or buildings, but they're, with that being a office space, there's going to need to be some pedestrian areas, exterior areas for people. There's going to be such a massive of people there, so that I think that will go a long way toward fulfilling these goals and objectives as it comes together. And this really talks about both public and private. There's a distinction there between the public realm and the private realm. And Walmart is it's a behemoth. It's a big, big box. And in a lot of ways, it does conform to the guidelines. I mean, in terms of the architectural and so forth, there was a lot of work done for that. There's landscaping, and there's extensions of the trails and pet connections. Granted, it's still a big box Walmart, but I think it's better than what it before we got here, but the end result is better than what it started as. I think as a result of trying to apply the North Kelsey to that. Could be better, but it could be a whole lot worse.
Bridget?
Thanks. This is a goal that I don't understand. It doesn't seem The one you were talking about, yeah, goal six. I'm rereading it, but create a place that complements but does not reproduce the aesthetics of downtown, meaning what? And enhancing connections. I don't know how that can be accomplished or what that even means. And between the site and downtown, are we gonna be putting in some kind of connecting transportation, or I don't know what that means either. And then the contrasting too is something odd to say, because there are going to be downtown, we have a pet dog food store, Sam's, probably in North Kelsey there's probably going to be a place, a similar kind of place. And downtown is retail, restaurants, and services, and isn't that what we're going to have at North Kelsey too? So I just don't even see the necessity for that one, but that's just my opinion.
Jeff?
I agree completely with that. Last time we talked about this, you said there really isn't any functional connection, nor would it behoove us to create one. I mean, these are two separate entities. And so I agree, I don't see any purpose anymore for this land use policy 2.6 or the goals.
Yeah, commissioners, is there anybody in love with this policy?
In love.
Just came to my mind. Anybody opposed to maybe just scratching this particular policy?
Scratching.
Paul?
I can't speak for this for when it was put together, but it is one of six goals, and I assume it had some kind of basis for being in the plan as one of six. I think the idea is that the North Kelsey, at least in the terms of this goal, would not be the death of downtown. I don't have a slide, but there was this concept, very schematic plan that showed connections from pedestrian connections from North Kelsey to downtown, and up Lewis became very much a pedestrian spine. Which sounds good in concept, but it's quite a distance from, say, the Walmart property or the Lowe's property to Lewis and Main, especially in rains around here all the time.
Yeah.
Dave?
I might be able to offer a little bit of insight on that, and that was, I think there was just some desire and effort to try to, maybe not realistically, but try to minimize the divisive nature of Highway 2. Mm-hmm. And the Highway 2, as it currently exists, is in many ways a great separator.
It is.
And, I mean, try to go from one side to the other as a pedestrian. Mm-hmm. And if you happen to be mid-block between North Kelsey and Lewis Street, you're probably going to jaywalk. And your life at risk of doing it. Because to walk all that way. Anyway, it was just some desire to try to, again, minimize that, create maybe some opportunity for some sense of connection.
Mm-hmm. And you can do that by design and by streetscape and by promoting some sense of connection. But I think the way I interpret this is that North Kelsey should evolve as distinctly different than the downtown, different character. I mean, they were kind of reaching toward the same elements, but I think they were tempering that by saying North Kelsey should not be another downtown Monroe, although in fact it is the 21st century of downtown. And there are so many cities where there are two downtowns. There's the old traditional downtown and the new modern shopping center, shopping mall turned inside out, lifestyle center. And in Monroe, if we were twice the size that we are, that might be able to pull that off successfully. But I think this has some value in that it confirms that North Kelsey is not downtown and vice versa. It works both ways. That they should be different.
And I think at the point that it was, that we had the North Kelsey plan in place, that does make sense. But now that there is a distinct difference between downtown, and that's all. And that's all.
I would agree. I don't feel that there's a whole lot of necessity for this particular land use policy. I know three of us have spoken on it. Three of us haven't. Bill, any opinion on it?
Well, I think, this is my personal feeling, is that somewhere there should be saying that we want to differentiate North Kelsey from downtown. We want to keep the flavor and the comfortness of the downtown area, but, you know, and keep that separate from the North Kelsey. We don't want North Kelsey to look like downtown.
Right.
And we don't want downtown to look like North Kelsey. So somehow, I think that we need something that says that in some nice language. And I don't think this, maybe the first sentence up until the part about providing uses, activity, and site designation characters, but something that says that, that we want to keep them separate but distinct.
Dave?
Well, my friend Mr. Sherwood, I think the market will take care of your concerns with regard to the and that the concerns for downtown need to be addressed in the downtown planning process. I don't care about six.
You're not in love.
I don't feel the love.
Oh boy.
See, that one's not going to let you. Maybe we'll change your opinion.
Yeah.
I don't have the idea or any idea how we're going to redo downtown. I've been working on that since 1961-2 with different groups. I hope somebody comes up with a plan.
Good things take time.
50 years, wow. Okay. Commissioners, anything else on this particular comprehensive plan amendment? So it sounds like next week will be downtown.
Yeah, I'll bring a similar package with some feedback from downtown. And,
next meeting, sorry.
See the whole thing in context again in 2 weeks. We'll talk about this a couple more times.
Great, thank you. Excellent.
Well, we're moving on.
ZCA 2204 sign code amendments. And
oh boy.
This one is going to be presented by Mark Lanigan. Is that right?
And I think Jeff.
And Jeff Sachs.
Sachs and Mark.
Yep. Mark Lanigan.
Lanigan.
Excellent.
Might be best if we come up to the mic up there so we can record it a little bit.
Okay. Record it. Please, you can. Go ahead.
Why are we doing this now?
I'm going to find out, I guess.
This happens every year.
Commission, Jeff Sachs, Economic Development Manager for the city. Why are we doing this now? Basically, what it came down to is we've got a structurally good code. Our code is not bad. There's places in it that are inconsistent. There are technologies that have developed since the last time we went through this process that need to be looked at and evaluated. And probably the biggest reason for this is that from a regulator's standpoint, it's a very difficult code to enforce, permit, consistently. There's very little room for discretion on the planning manager's part, and at the same time, when we run into an unusual circumstance, it puts a big imposition on business. And I'll give you three examples of where the mayor and the planning staff have come up against something that basically just didn't make any sense. And from there, we kind of the mayor asked us to go through and start restructuring the code. And again, it's not that we're rewriting the code. We've formed an ad hoc committee, and we've found about 12 or 13 items that we feel need attention. And so what we're doing right now is going through the code, inserting these new items that we think need attention, and we will be bringing to the Planning Commission soon. Not really soon, but
this year.
This is not a comprehensive plan push, but it's not something we want to dally on either. Banners are a problem around town, and not only banners, but temporary signs. And what is a temporary sign? Are the red and, or the orange and black signs for Bearcat Fridays signs that are put up on Main Street? Are banners that are strung on the side of buildings that are nailed up tight are those signs or are they banners? Temporary signs. You go down to the Arco station and they've got all sorts of little things around their corner. Emerald City Smoothie, Wyatt Jewelers, that little subdivision. They had a big banner hanging up there for a long time, you know, a pole flag type sign. When we went out to enforce the code, Paul sent one of our guys out to start enforcing the code, and it was a very gentle nudge, and you would have thought that the china cabinet fell over. It was very noisy around City Hall for a little while. And so what it showed us was that for a long time we haven't enforced the code, number one. Businesses aren't accustomed to having the code enforced. Number two, we have portions of the code that are very difficult to impossible to enforce. And then number three, it needs an update. Another example, when Bridgestone was looking to purchase the property just south of Lowe's, you probably have heard this story, but when we looked at the sign code for the North Kelsey area, in order for them to put up a sign that could be read from Chaden Lake when you drive by, I think you're about 17 feet below grade down to the Lowe's parking lot right there. And so you have to bring it up 17 feet and then another 9 or 10 feet above that to get up to a visual sight that's appealing to a motorist to look at. So in order to build this sign, it was going to have to be a monument that was 22 feet wide,
35
feet tall, and it was solid. It was a wall. And across the top were 16-inch letters that said Bridgestone Tire. And that was it. That was the sign.
And that was legal.
That was legal. And there was no other sign. There's no room for interpretation. They could go through a variance. And believe it or not, that was probably the issue that led us to realize that the North Kelsey plan was actually embedded into the comprehensive plan. And in order to change the sign code to create some flexibility for planning staff, we couldn't without a comprehensive plan change. So, you know, these things kind of tumble upon each other, and sometimes when you pull the string, the whole sweater comes untangled. So, in this case, I'm going to let Mark talk about quite a few of the specifics, but I just did want to address that, you know, there's several items that we're inserting into the code. It was my decision to pick a small, very ad hoc type committee of people to work on this in a very tight, quiet environment, not controversial at all, and then present it to you guys and let the controversy show up in front of you guys. I'm happy to answer questions, then we'll let Mark finish out here.
Who's on the committee?
Dick Steimert from SignCo, and Elton Bartelheimer, president of the chamber, myself, Mark, and Paul. That's it. Originally, we were trying to get, I think his name's Raul from Big Sides to join us. And my idea was, number one, who uses a sign for the most part? Businesses. And who better to understand what a business sign requires than a sign builder? And I thought Elton, for multiple reasons, but Elton was involved in the sign COVID development last time. And he's current president of the chamber, and he was very interested in participating.
Thank you.
There you go. Oh,
Jeff. Jeff, do you feel like the whole sign thing's out of control? Are you getting complaints from citizens who are saying, you know, our town's turning ugly because there's so many signs, and the Statue of Liberty's out there trying to sell tax services.
And a mattress.
All the mattress. Don't forget the mattress.
Yeah, the mattress.
No, is the answer to that question.
So why are we doing this, though?
Well, to a large degree, what my goal is to get a code that's permittable, consistent, and enforceable. How signs look is that gets very ethereal, it gets very artistic, it's very much one person's opinion. And what my concept here is to build a code that fits those three criteria. How those signs look is open to interpretation. What I've asked Elton Bartelheimer to do is to start working through the Chamber of Commerce with the chamber and establish some sort of a program within the chamber that encourages chamber members to have responsible, good-looking signs that meet the code. And typically the chamber members are the long-term businessmen, women in town, and they have a vested interest in the community. And by them upgrading and them following the code, we can start to bring the rest of the community, business community, up to speed. But that way, it's the business community out using peer pressure, if you will, or competition to encourage quality signage out there. At the same time, when, you know, we have Hot Sexy Coffee putting up a A-board in the middle of the sidewalk, when the code is done, we are... planning department will feel comfortable walking by and picking that sign up and taking it away. Or, in a circumstance, Paul and I mentioned, talked to comfortably one day, somebody coming up, throwing a ladder up the side of the building and clipping down a banner that's been there for 6 months because the sign owner refuses to take it down or upgrade their signage. Now, my experience is when you start to enforce things like that, you get a big reaction like we did. But if we have a solid code to work off of, I think the reactions will be tempered down substantially.
So have you had the response from business owners that they feel it's onerous to them the way it is now? It doesn't allow them enough signage or big enough signage?
Yes.
But you're getting that kind of feedback?
Yes.
And presumptively then you're working towards something that will help businesses advertise their services without... having an obnoxious appearance.
Absolutely. Okay. That's correct.
Thank you.
Jeff, real quick, more of a comment than anything else. You figured out that we are very willing to hash things out and tear things apart. So I appreciate you getting to...
at great detail.
Yeah, I appreciate you getting to, you know, some people in the community together to kind of identify the problems and hopefully some... solutions to present to us, and we'll still pick it apart, I'm sure, but at least you're giving us a good direction, and I appreciate
it. It's just always been my belief and my experience when I sat on that side of the bench is that you know, I liked well-formulated ideas that were logical, presented. You guys are the ones that are supposed to take the public comment. I don't think that staff should go out and generate a whole big deal out in the community prior to that happening. Now, if it gets through you guys and goes to the council and the council wants to do that, that's within their authority. But I think what our job is to give you a good, solid, rough draft to start working on.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
All right.
Just quick word about enforcement. We did start doing some light enforcement, but I should say that as much as we'd like to literally take a ladder and go up and start taking the thing down, we always work with the owners to try and resolve it in a positive way. Educate a little bit and resolve the problem. In some cases, they, you know, ideally they will take down the illegal signage or they will make some changes to conform. But we try not to be too arrogant about it. But enforcement is very difficult, especially when you don't have a good solid basis to say this is illegal and has to come down.
Gotcha.
We'll get there.
Mark?
Floor is yours.
All right. Well, I'm Mark Landkammer, and I've been your city planner on the current planning side, the regulatory side, since the 1st of June 2011. So, I've been here long enough to get my feet wet, but not so long that I've gotten to know you real well, and I think that's part of my mission here tonight is just to show up and show you that I'm here and that I'm working and that I'm doing the things it takes, such as the side code. And the way I see it, one of the biggest... parts of a reason to work on this sign code is that I know Monroe wants to be business friendly, and we want to be able to turn these sign applications around in a hurry and get people out there. And and get their signs up and get commerce flowing and things like that. And so from a regulator point of view, we see sign applications probably between once and half a dozen times a week, sometimes less, sometimes more, but probably if you average it out over the year, 3 or 4 signs a week. And to be quite honest with you, pretty much every one of those signs, we have to scrutinize this code, get together, put our heads together, talk to Paul, talk to Kim, talk to Brad, figure out what it is the code is really saying and what it is we really have to do to regulate the signs so that our final decision is defensible and so that it's equitable for all the business owners out there. And right now, I have to be honest, it really isn't that way. And in front of you in your packet, you have the 12. I've got them written a little differently because, well, that's the way I started out. But what I'm not going to take the time to go through those in great detail, but there's a few of them that I think are really important that kind of answer some of your questions that you had earlier about why are we doing this. We have a question hanging over us about what to do about video and electronic displays. We have a lot of businesses that are coming in and wanting to have some of those kind of dynamic displays, and I think it bears a look at by all of us and see if we should allow those, and if we do, where should they be allowed, and how big, and how bright, and a lot of the language that we have in our code is just plain archaic, and incomprehensible, really. Some of the simple things, like what surface of a building can a sign go on? We've gone around and around that with a number of different applications that we've had come in. The one that immediately comes to mind is Pacific Battery. They have a beautiful storefront out on Main Street. They have a side wall on the north wall that faces the bank. Do y'all know where that is? I think it's 212 North East Main. And they wanted to put a sign on that wall so that when folks come in west on Main Street saw their sign there. But in our code, it's not clear whether they can put, at best, it's not clear about whether they can put a sign on that wall or not. And we've seen that a number of times. And frankly, it takes a lot of staff time, and it takes, to not immediately be able to answer an applicant on a question. I have to tell them, I'm going to have to research this, when it could be clear. That would just really be nice as regulators to be able to have some clear rules that we can apply instantly and get these sign applications approved and out and working for everyone. One of the other ones is the internal tenant or small building frontage signs. Right now, if you are in a building that has multiple tenants and you do not have frontage on the street, there really is no way in our code to allow signs for you out there or for us as regulators to understand exactly how much sign you can have and where it belongs and all of those kind of things. The coffee stands, as we all know, especially out here in the West, towns are prone to having lots of coffee stands. Right now, our code does not address what to do with a coffee stand. Can you put a sign on all four sides? How big can that sign be? You know, how many of them, et cetera. It just, the word coffee stand or the phrase coffee stand just doesn't even show up in our code. And so when those come in, we're not exactly sure what to do with them. It just would be helpful to your staff if we could have rules that are more clear. And so, as Jeff said, we've begun to kind of small steps with just a few people and trying to get a handle on where the rubs are within the current code and come up with some ways that those inconsistencies might be fixed. And then we hope to, in sometime in the near future, bring that before you and present something intelligent and that will lend itself to good discussion between all of us and between all of Monroe, and end up with just a little tighter sign code. As Jeff said, it's not completely broken, but there's some things that really need to be fixed that we run across on a weekly basis, and so we're just kind of asking you to let us go forth and come back to you with some cogent fixes and move forward from there. I think that's all I got.
Thank you. Commissioners, any questions? Comments, Jeff?
Have either of you or anybody in the committee found a municipality or county that help save you some work? Where you drive through and you say, you know, those signs, like Dr. Muckleteo would say, you know, that signage is nice and it's scaled properly and all those things and it's not too bright and all that. Have you received any help in finding places like that?
Yeah, luckily for all of us, we have a wealth of experience here. I don't know. But between Paul and I alone, we have decades of experience. And I spent a lot of time in Missoula, Montana.
Wow.
And they recently went through a zoning code rewrite. And one of the things they did was they worked on their sign code. So I found that to be a really nice resource. But we also have the books in our office from the American Planning Association, and of course these days the web is just fabulous, and so we've gone out and looked at sign codes from other cities, and from our travels and we know where some nice cities are and how did they get their signs to be as good as they are, and we've been going through and doing that kind of research and background.
So the software exists where you can scan a sign plan and it pops out to the conforms.
Did I say that?
No, it means nothing.
No, they've got to put an appraiser's tax on you for all appraisers. Fund that software application.
We pour over every one of them and go through the code and try to see where the applications fit and don't fit. And then we scratch our heads a lot. And somehow we can come up with a determination about whether a sign can be approved or not. A lot of times, we'd like to be on a place where we just, our decisions are infinitely defensible. As it stands, sometimes we make a call and we say, okay, this is what the sign code intended and we're going to make this decision on it, yay or nay, or bigger or smaller or whatever it might be. And we don't necessarily have a place to point to in the code that says, this is why we're able to allow that sign to be the way it is. And that's what we're shooting for.
Wayne?
Yes, I've been through many of these. This, you could be opening a can of worms. I have seen this issue lasts for weeks and months and argue, and nobody ever got to mind unanimously how it should be done. But good luck.
Thank you. I think we're blessed to have Paul here, and you have a really great team, and I think between us all, we can put this together and improve upon it. I know you're right. It's hard. I've been there before too, and we never said it was going to be easy, but we can improve upon it.
For the record, I'd rather improve in a nuclear power plant than do a site.
Yeah, I think anytime you mention revising a sign code, everybody just.
Yeah, we'll try not to get too carried away, and you know, we want to hit some specific things that need to be hammered out, and not open the whole thing and go nuts. Because as Wayne says, it would never end. A can of worms, I think, was it.
Well, I have to say that a couple things I really appreciate that I've heard tonight. One is you said that. You know, Monroe's wanting to be business friendly, and being sometimes involved in our clients needing to go in for approval for signage and trying to figure out how I'm going to draw this thing on this building to fit the codes. It's nice that you're having that as your forefront. I like the idea that you put a couple sign manufacturers and business owners all together on this to receive those comments. I think is very helpful because they're very knowledgeable. So. Those are just my opinions. Dave?
Perhaps we should thank Dick. He's been involved in every rewrite in the last 20 years.
Commissioners, any other questions?
I just wanted to add one more item that, you know, there's been some talk that we're destroying the downtown sign code. You know, one of the things that probably sparked the downtown rewrite was in the downtown plan that's embedded in the comprehensive plan. Talks about signage downtown, and it says you should consider fluorescence. If anybody's been downtown in the last 6 months has seen fluorescence. You know, lovers, what does fluorescent mean? And that, you know, that's a vagary. The concept here is we want a citywide sign code, but respect certain areas of town. And I think downtown is an area that all of us want to maintain the respect for that downtown plan. The downtown plan, I think all of us on the whole committee, the mayor, have said that the downtown is kind of a protected class, if you will. And we need to get that plan and start implementing. And somebody asked a question earlier today about, you know, when are we going to implement the downtown plan? Was that you, Wayne? It's 1962, I think you said. So, that's part of the conversation. And we're not trying to destroy, we're just trying to rebuild it. To make it consistent citywide for all businesses.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, no further discussion on that. We can move on to, I've got a two-page deal here. Discussion by commissioners and staff. Paul, anything?
I don't think so.
All right. Bridget? Wayne? Dave?
Any word on the vacancy?
No, I need to put together some words to get on the website.
Great.
On my list. Get them.
I know some interested people, so they're going to be calling me this week.
Good.
Excellent. Jeff?
Nope.
Bill?
Just one thing. I don't know how many people know I'm on the Parks Board.
Oh, yeah.
Planning Commission's representative on Parks and Recreation. Yeah, one of the things that happened at the last meeting I was at, I missed the last meeting, but the meeting previous to that was some people showed up and did a presentation on what they'd like to do to the skate park over by Lake Ty. They want to donate some time and material to add some art to the skate park that would actually be incorporated in the skate park, so they would use it like there'd be maybe some kind of a dome or a ramp would be on it or something that would be an art piece. So I thought it was a great idea because all it is right now is just a concrete thing that with some bolted down, you know, ramps and jumps and stuff like that that's there now. So they're talking about actually donating, and it wouldn't cost the city anything, so they would donate the time and material and the artistry to add that in. I thought it was a great idea.
Well, that is. Thank you. I don't have anything except to say I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
The motion was made by Commissioner Sherwood, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes.
Seconded by Commissioner Christensen. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.